Good evening, everybody. The time is 5:30. I'll just check if we're good to go, Sam. Thank you. Good evening. My name's Paula Roche, the Mayor of Kingborough, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all to tonight's council meeting on Monday the 15th of August. We don't have anyone in the public gallery this evening, which is not surprising because it is a very chilly night. But a very warm welcome to everyone who is watching the live stream at home via YouTube. Being 5:30, I now officially declare the meeting open. I wish to advise that council meetings are recorded and made publicly available on our website. And in accordance with council's policy, I'll ask the general manager to confirm that the audio recording has started.
Confirmed.
Thank you. I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, pay respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge today's Aboriginal community. Our attendees this evening are myself, Councillor Reet, Deputy Mayor Councillor Westwood, Councillor Bastone, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Fox, Councillor Gladewright, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Street and Councillor Wass. From our staff this evening we have with us the General Manager Mr Arnold, the Chief Financial Officer Mr Breen, Director of Governance, Recreation and Property Services Mr Smee, the Acting Director of Environment, Development and Community Services Mrs Salisbury, our Manager of Works Mr Johnson, our Coordinator of Statutory Planning Mrs Stevenson, our Senior Environmental Planner Ms Den Exter, our NAB Coordinator Ms Quinn, our Media and Communications Advisor Ms Adams and our Executive Assistant Mrs Morton. We also have apologies this evening from Councillor Grace. Moving to page one, confirmation of minutes. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder that the minutes of the open session of Council Meeting number 15 held on the 1st of August 2022 be confirmed as a true record. Moved Councillor Gladewright, seconded Councillor Fox. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Still on page one, workshops held since the last council meeting. We had a workshop last Monday evening, the 8th of August, in relation to waste. Page two, declarations of interest. Does any councillor have a declaration of interest that they would like to declare? No? Thank you very much. Transfer agenda items. Is there any item on the agenda that a councillor would like to move from closed into open session or open into closed session? No, thank you very much. As there are no members of the public with us this evening, there will be no questions without notice from the public. Questions on notice from the public, I would encourage our residents who are wanting to ask a question that they can send an email to us at kc@kingborough.tas.gov.au, and that question will then appear in a subsequent council agenda with a response. This evening on page two, we have one that was submitted from AJ Kingston in relation to public open space funds and an officer's response from Mr Breen. Moving along now to questions without notice from councillors. I have Councillor Westwood, then Bastone, then Cordova. Councillor Westwood.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a question regarding the Mayor's diary. On page 200, it notes that on the 1st of August you met with Minister Street regarding the Channel Ambulance Station, Kingston Emergency Services Hub. I was wondering if you could provide councillors with an update on that, please.
So that meeting was originally scheduled to take place with Minister Street and Minister Petrusma in her capacity as Minister for Police and Emergency Services. Unfortunately, she was had resigned by that stage, but the meeting went ahead regardless with Minister Street as a member for Franklin. You may recall that as a council we passed a motion some time ago about the need for an ambulance station in the Channel, and so at that meeting the General Manager and I advocated for that to occur. Present at the meeting was also a police commander and also Inspector Burke from Kingston Police Station, and so we also took the opportunity to talk about what the future might look like in terms of a one-stop emergency services hub in Kingborough that would incorporate the police station, fire, ambulance and SES. So one of the issues that we've previously identified is that the fire station on Redwood Road is not sort of suitable for contemporary standards in terms of their training. The facilities are not appropriate for having volunteers of all genders in the brigade, and they've run out of space, so they're turning volunteers away. Likewise, the ambulance accommodation at the same premises isn't very, very comfortable. So we see an opportunity, and we also do know that the police station, now that they have 30 staff, is at capacity. So if we are going to move to a model in the future where there is a 24-hour police station in Kingborough, it can't happen at that site. So we had a broad-ranging discussion about potential locations, and following that, Minister Street was very supportive. We're going to be seeking a meeting with the Premier and the Minister for Emergency Services to follow that up further.
Thank you. That sounds very positive. I have one more question for closed session on the organisational development report from page 218.
Thank you. Councillor Bastow, then Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. I have several questions. I'm sorry, I'll make them as brief as possible. The old Kettering Oval in Saddle Road, which has had two tree planting days on it, what are the future plans for this block of land?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, Council haven't prepared a master plan for that site. It remains as public open space, and will be used as such unless there's any alternate suggestions for the land.
The ambulance, the paramedics that I've been speaking to are suggesting that would be an excellent place to have a paramedic station, ambulance station. Very easy to get to Bruny, very easy to get across to Signet in that area, and easy to come back to Margate. So if you could put that into the plans in your thoughts. Secondly, what are the rules regarding setting up of a scrapyard? The property on Channel Highway and the corner of Manuka Road now has signs on it advertising that they're a scrapyard. I'm just wondering what we can do about it. The signs were there, they were removed when the council came out to inspect the large number of trees that had been cut down, and as soon as the council officers left, the signs were back again. So what are the rules for putting a scrapyard in?
Who's the lucky winner of this? Oh, Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. I'm not familiar with that particular issue, but generally speaking, in terms of any business like that, that would need to be identified under the planning scheme in terms of the use class and the zoning. A scrapyard would be something that would ordinarily need a planning permit. It would depend upon what the zoning of the property was and what the use fitted into in terms of whether that was permitted or discretionary or even prohibited. I'd have to look into that further, but I can do so for you if you like.
Thank you. That would be good. My next question is about Bruny Island, the recladding of the Access Centre building at the Bruny Island School. It has been trying to have been accomplished for some time now, and it continues to come to the planning department and be rejected. The fire assessment says that it is effectively a repair to an existing building using exactly the same footprint, and the colour bond cladding is likely to enhance the building's tolerance to bushfire over what is an existing timber cladding. There's also a heritage issue. Two buildings within the site are heritage listed, but this building is not. So can we have some detail as to why it's not able to go ahead?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. There is an application before Council which is on further information. Ms. Dennextra is actually probably the most appropriate officer to answer the questions in relation to the bushfire issue, so if that's okay, I'll pass over to her.
Through you, Mayor. Yes, it is out on further information for bushfire. Schools are a vulnerable use, so it triggers the Bushfire Prone Areas Code and less exempt. So we're currently waiting for either complete documentation to satisfy the exemption or documentation to demonstrate compliance with the code. We're liaising with TasFire to make sure that what we've asked for is fair and reasonable, and we've been guided by them, and to date their advice is that we do still need further justification in relation to the potential exemption. It's quite possible it is okay from a bushfire point of view, but they haven't provided the full documentation needed to show that at this point.
Thank you.
I think you'll be hearing some more from them. Could we find out when the doggy bags are going to be installed on Bruny Island, please? Mr. Reeve is not here.
No. I might have to take that one on notice.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Through you, Mayor. Thanks for the question. Typically, the dog bags and dispensers are managed through the waste transfer station, so but I'm happy to follow that up with the manager.
That would be wonderful, thank you. And I think I'll leave it there and do the rest for next week.
Thank you. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, ma'am. My first question is about neighbourhood noise complaints. So recently a number of constituents have come forward to me with noise complaints, and I'm not speaking about any individual noise complaint here, just more generally. As the density of our neighbourhoods continues to increase with near record population growth, what advice does the council have for residents who have a concern about noise emanating from a neighbour's property? Is there a best practice set of steps to take? What action can council take to intervene in such a situation, and at what trigger point? And what is the best practice set of steps that people can take where a neighbour is causing noise pollution?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Whenever we receive a complaint regarding noise emission, Councillor Cordova, it's directed to our environmental services team, who do have some ability under the appropriate legislation to not only investigate but take action if a nuisance is proven. But in relation to the rest of your questions, probably best to take it on notice so that we can place it on the public record.
Thank you. My next set of questions are about the Mayor's diary. On the 13th of May, I'm interested to find out a little bit more about the site visit to Blackmans Bay Blowhole with residents to view fencing. Is there some update about the height of the fence?
I'm glad I can remember that one because my COVID brain is still struggling to remember what I did last week. But yes, so I've got quite a substantial report that I was given by residents to read. There is some concern by some residents about a couple of aspects of the fence. One is in relation to a foothold where access has been granted for or is available for people who want to do abseiling. There's quite a distinct looking foothold that could be inappropriately used. But also there were some concerns about the fact that the fence on the southern side is still being, people are still walking in front of it to get to where they want to get to rather than staying behind it. So yes, that is something that I still have to read the report.
Thanks. And so at this stage, is it fair to say that there's no action in the works?
Not at this stage, no.
Thank you. My next question, final question, is regarding the meeting with the Kingborough Dog Walkers on the 3rd of August.
Mm-hmm.
What did that entail, and is there any update that you'd like to pass along?
Yep. So we have a quarterly meeting, the Deputy Mayor and myself, with the Kingborough Dog Walkers Association on a number of issues. It's always a really interesting discussion. I did relay to them that we had considered a dog strategy as part of our budget deliberations, but it unfortunately did just not quite make the cut. But I have asked the association to think about what they would like to see in a strategy when we're able to do that in the future. They wanted to talk about whether we had any powers as a council to declare not just dogs but all animals, but I think specifically from where they were coming from, dogs as sentient beings, so that when dogs or other animals are being harmed, that we have more powers then to remove them from harm's way, because we know we've all read about cases where the RSPCA haven't had those sorts of powers available to them. And I did write back to them today just to let them know that that is a difficult issue for us because we don't really have the statutory power to do that or make a bylaw to do that. It would only be just a bit of a tokenistic response. It needs to come at a state level. I do know that, so for example, the ACT have declared dogs as sentient beings. But that's an issue that they've been working on, and they do have a animal behaviourist veterinarian who works with them and who's recently written to the state government about that. And they were also very appreciative of the new water troughs that have been installed at the Suncoast track dog walking area and also the Kingston View Drive area. And we're also installing another one at Drew Point shortly as well. They're just quite low troughs and apparently they've been very well used by the dogs that are visiting there with their owners. We just have a general discussion about where we could make improvements. We've had a long standing discussion about the difficulties of the biodegradable dog poo bags and where they go. So there's always different issues that we chat about, but we try to make that a quarterly thing. It's a good learning experience for me as a non-dog owner as well. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. A couple of questions, and I'll also try to be quick, knowing it's a big agenda. The Environmental Services Report is always a great read, and it covers the great work that the team does. The first question relating to that one on page 202 regarding the wildlife and roadkill, noting that the response or the report there says that the support for this community-driven project will be ongoing in regards to working with a community group to look at how we can reduce wildlife being killed on the roads. But I'm wondering what other initiatives council is taking, noting that when I go out for my morning walk at 7 a.m. I'm often seeing at least two or more, and many people are reporting more to me. So I'm wondering what else are we doing in this space to reduce the increasing what seems wildlife killed on our roads.
Ms. Quinn, no? Yes, thank you. Ms. Quinn.
Thank you, through you, Mayor. It's a really difficult space to work in, so the main thing that WIDA's officers in the natural areas team is keep in contact with the state government, who obviously through the Save the Tasmanian Devil program have trialled lots of different things on roads. So we've been keeping up with that research to see if any of those things have been successful. And unfortunately, there's been a lot of trials about how to keep wildlife off roads, and not many of it are successful. So there was great hope that the virtual fencing was going to be successful, and it actually hasn't been. It was in the Tark Line initially, but in the second trials on Huon Highway and other sites, it wasn't. So obviously council does signage, which again is mostly a fairly tokenistic. We know that people generally don't. It doesn't change their driving behaviour, the signage. The thing that does are the short-term measures. So we use the road trailer signage, like we're using in school zones at the moment. We've used that before at the time when young devils are moving around, because people seem to take notice of those things that are only there for a short amount of time. And the other thing, a large thing we do, is to take a lot of the roadkill off the road so that other animals aren't coming and feeding on the roadkill. But a difficult space, and that's why we're trying to support the community to come up with anything novel that they can as well.
Great. Thank you very much. In regards to the fantastic talk about the National Tree Day, which was another really wonderfully organised event. If the community identifies a patch that they would like to see for further tree planting, e.g. there's an area behind Kingston Park where we did have a tree planting day, I don't know how many years ago, maybe 7 years ago or so by memory, I think I turned up there. There's a patch next to there, and a few people have said, wouldn't it be great to extend that? What's the process in regards to another tree planting happening in different locations?
Ms. Quinn.
Through you, Mayor. So if the land's on council land, then I just ask that people email council to KC and let us know about those sites. That's the best, and we can log them. There is a lot of consideration in National Tree Day, selecting National Tree Day sites, because we have to think about a whole range of things, not only tenure, but about bushfire, impact on adjacent landowners, traffic, where future infrastructure might be. So a lot of sites look like they could be useful and then aren't, Aboriginal heritage, a whole range of things. National tree day sites also need to be quite large, as you know, so because there's a lot of people and a lot of plants to go in. But smaller sites can certainly be selected for different activities that aren't National tree day. So, but the best thing is if people let us know.
Great. Look at Thank you. And the final question, just an update on the Transform Kingston project, please.
It's just me.
Through you, Mayor. So since Council made its decision with respect to the concept design, what's happening now is the detailed design work is underway, and that's with a view to going to tender for those works at the end of this year with construction early in the new year. Other than that, we've been completing the works on the Whitewater Creek track to provide the active transport connection improvements into the CBD, and work behind the scenes in relation to car parking, which we will be bringing to council at some stage in the near future.
Sorry. Any further questions without notice? I just, before we move on, wanted to just highlight out of the report, Environmental Services report, the issues of cat management, because there was a really positive story in here on all aspects of cat management. Interestingly enough, and I hadn't caught up on this fact until I read this report, that Allen's Rivulet is the new hotspot for stray cats, with 12 being sighted. So, Councillor Cordova, you could become a one-person vigilante here for stray cats in Allen's Rivulet. But to date, three of those cats have actually been trapped. But I thought what was really interesting that around Blackmans Bay, where we were trying to preserve the little penguins and the brown bandicoots, last year there were 22 cats, stray cats, that had been trapped in that area, and now there's only two sightings that have been made. So that's certainly a really good improvement, and I think it shows that the community has been really vigilant in reporting this. But also the Boronia Beach Reserve, over 5 weeks there was only one cat and no dogs found on camera, and that was significantly different from the same time in 2019. So those things are really having an impact. And I met with our cat management officer last week, and she remains as enthusiastic as ever about the success of those programs and also the ones on Bruny Island. So even though I was wearing a dog brooch today, I'm still talking about cats. Okay, if there are no further questions on notice, questions on notice. We had two from Councillor Midgley, one in relation to Davies Road upgrade with an officer's response from Mr Johnson, and another one from Councillor Midgley in relation to FOGO signage at Beretta with a response from Mr Reeve. The open session of Council now adjourns, and the Planning Authority commences at 5:52 p.m. Turning now to page four, DA 2022-104, development application for 5 multiple dwellings, demolition of existing dwelling and outbuilding at 36 Power Road, Blackmans Bay, and tree removal at 32 Tolone Road, Blackmans Bay, with a recommendation on page 17. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder. Moved Councillor Gladright, seconded Councillor Street. Councillor Gladright.
Thank you. The proposal is for the development of 5 multiple dwellings, which will offer a range of accommodation options and contribute to urban consolidation and housing choice, which is really good given the current housing crisis. I note that Blackmans Bay area is characterised as a highly urbanised area with adequate infrastructure required to cater for such a development. The proposal is located on a large lot size and is able to accommodate the 5 multiple dwellings while providing for adequate setbacks and outdoor amenity. 3 representations were received, and I feel pretty confident that the officers have addressed the concerns adequately in their responses. I do have a question about Unit 5. I note that the provisions of PD 8, which commenced this year in February, do not have a minimum building setback requirement for the rear boundary, where the building length is less than 9 metres. So I suspect this is the beginnings of this type of proposal, which the community are going to have to start getting used to, I think. But I just wanted to check with that Unit 5, It says a small portion of the roof line would fall outside the building envelope. That doesn't mean the building envelope is just where the building is that right? Not over the boundary of the
yep.
property.
It's probably best illustrated on page 10, the top and middle diagram.
Yeah, I was looking at that, but it seemed to be well and truly within its building area, so I didn't quite understand.
Ms. Stevenson, did you want to provide some clarification for us?
Yes, thank through you, Mayor. So the building envelope is a three-dimensional envelope, and it's based on the measurements from the boundary where you go vertically 3 metres and then in on a 45-degree angle. So previous to the PD8 provisions coming in, the planning scheme required a 4-metre rear boundary setback. That's now been changed so that the rear boundary is treated the same as a side boundary, which enables you to go within 1.5 metres of the boundary. If you're less than 1.5 metres from the boundary, there is the restriction of a maximum of 9 metres or 1/3 of the boundary. So in relation to this particular unit, it meets the setback requirements in that it's not within 1.5 metres of the boundary or less than the 9 metres, but the vertical envelope, if you like, there's a small portion of the roof which is outside of that vertical envelope.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Gladewright. Any further discussion? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. A couple of questions and then I'll speak to it. So in terms of if the proposal was 4 units rather than 5, for example, if the proposed unit 5 was not included, would the proposal have been able to comply with the setbacks and the building envelope acceptable solutions?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Sorry, through you, Mayor. Just let me double check that. But yes, so Unit 5 is the only one that's outside, except for the retaining walls. So the units themselves would be contained within the building envelope, but there are retaining walls on the site which are less than 1.5 metres from the boundary and are greater than 9 metres. So they are outside the building envelope. But in terms of the units, the rest of the units would be within the building envelope.
Thank you. And I guess, I too was a little bit confused as to why it was necessary. I realise that it's a performance criteria that, you know, we have our discretion to decide, but I just didn't understand why the design required the roof to actually exceed the... was that like a design necessity in order to fit on Unit 5 that the roof had to exceed the envelope? Is that what was happening there?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. Effectively, yes, in terms of the way the unit has been designed. They have stepped the unit back in to minimise the amount of area that would be outside the envelope. So you can see in on page 10, figure 5, you can see how they've stepped the upper level back in from the garage. So it's only a very small portion. You can see where it's basically just cutting the edge of the roof that's actually outside the building envelope, and the diagrams in figure 4 illustrate that area, so it's just that little slither, if you like, through the back. So in effect, yes, it is a design. I suspect to be able to actually make it comply would have been quite difficult with a two-storey house, unless they brought it forward, and then bringing it forward would potentially, as in further away from the boundary, would have potentially had other issues in terms of separation between units, fitting, car parking, manoeuvring and all those other things in.
Thank you. And just for reference, on page 37 there's a full page diagram that illustrates this, so it's a bit easier to see there on page 37. Now my next question is about something I struggled with in terms of the shadow diagram, and I recognise that the representations touched on this substantially. In the aerial image of the site on page 7 and on Google Maps, number 34 Powell Road has an outbuilding that is hard up against the boundary of the subject site. The outbuilding does not appear in the shadow diagram. And so that issue was raised in one of the representations. And my question really is, has that outbuilding been removed? If not, why doesn't that outbuilding that's directly to the northwest, why does that not appear in the shadow diagram?
Mrs. Stevenson, sorry.
That's okay. Through you, Mayor. Sorry, can I just clarify which property the outbuilding is on that you're referring to?
Yeah, so if we turn to page 38, there's the large version of the shadow diagram.
Yep.
And I'm looking at, if you take the 9 a.m. If you take the 9 a.m. shadow diagram, in the very top right-hand corner of that square, there's a single dwelling. But actually, if you look at the aerial image on page 7, you can see that that single dwelling actually has an outbuilding situated to the northwest of that dwelling. There's a shed there or some kind of outbuilding that's hard up against the boundary of 38 Powell. Does anybody else see that?
Yeah.
So where's that building gone? Why isn't it in the shadow diagram?
Through you, Mayor?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the answer probably is that the imagery layers that the designers were using for the shadow diagrams is different to the image that you see in our map info system. So that image, that building may or may not still be there. I can't confirm that. It could just be that the data that they're using is either predates or postdates, depending on whether that shed's still there. Having said that, from the purposes of assessing the application, impacts on overshadowing of an outbuilding wouldn't be relevant under the performance criteria. So that wasn't an issue that it's not there for the purposes of the assessment.
Northwest. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Councillor Cordover, do you have any further questions?
I did have one further question, and it is... it'll come to me in
that's
a
right.
bit.
That's right, I can come back to you if you want.
I'll just raise through my contribution, okay, if that's all right. So we're looking at the 5 units in Blackmans Bay, 4 of which are double-storey. This is a large residential lot, as has been said. The proposal includes the removal of a radiata pine. That's fine. That was my question. The radiata pine is on a different title, but is that the same owner? Is that why it's okay to remove that radiata pine?
Mr. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. My understanding is that it wouldn't be on the same title, no. Off the top of my head, I'm not sure whether the consent was provided from that property owner or not, but the planning process doesn't require their consent at the lodgement of the application. It does require their consent to be... it does require the applicant to notify them of the making of the application. I suspect that there's probably been discussions between the property owners in regards to that, though.
Thank you. I'll just raise through my contribution now to justify my position. As we can see from page 7, the zone purpose statement includes a provision for a range of dwelling types. I agree with that. Residential development that respects the neighbourhood character, and that's what I'll be speaking to, and encourage urban consolidation and greater housing choice. The planning scheme states that the following objectives for Blackmans Bay can be seen on page 8. So this is 10.1.2, general residential. Blackmans Bay, this is a quote, should be maintained as an established residential area with a high level of amenity associated with its coastal location, pleasant views and lifestyle. To the desired future character statements, quote, Blackmans Bay should continue as a predominantly low-density residential area with larger lot sizes that enable reasonable setbacks, the retention of native vegetation and gardens, end quote. The implementation strategy for this statement is, quote, new development should respect the amenity of surrounding residences and the natural landscape. Multi-unit housing should be encouraged to locate in the area surrounding the Opal Drive commercial precinct, end quote. So whilst this application is classified as permitted use, it relies on performance criteria to comply with the scheme provisions and is therefore discretionary. So to be clear, the word discretionary here means that the planning authority has the freedom to decide what should be done in the particular situation, having regard to, quote, the issues raised in the representations, the outcomes of any state policies and the objectives of Schedule 1 of the Land Use Planning and Approvals Act, end quote. The discretions are... the main ones that I'm talking to are the setbacks and building envelopes, so that's 10.4.2A3, and then privacy for all dwellings, 10.4.6A3. So the proposal doesn't comply, and we've heard bits about those minor non-compliance issues in terms of the roof. I note the commentary on page 15 regarding PD8, saying that there's no minimum building setbacks requirements for the rear boundary, as Councillor Gladewright alluded to. I also think it's worth noting that in Kingborough Council's own submission to the Planning Commission regarding PD8 on the 17th of May, dot point 12 reads, General Residential Zone, clause 10.4.2A3, the requirement for a rear setback should not have been removed. This is likely to lead to detrimental impacts on the amenity, including solar access for abutting dwellings. This is becoming more and more of an issue as infill development is encouraged and where backyards will be smaller and have less options for solar access. So that was Kingborough Council's own submission to that PDA, and I think it's worth noting. It's also worth noting that the decks here don't comply. They're too small. They're 16.35 metres and the acceptable solution is 24 metres. With a minimum horizontal dimension of 4 metres. However, I think that at page 13 it justifies that performance criteria. But of course, a major issue raised by the representors was overshadowing. To quote page 11, the properties to the west will be impacted between 9am and 11am on the 21st of June. It's considered that the arrangement of the multiple dwellings is that more than 50% of each dwelling's private open space receives a minimum of 3 hours sunlight between 9 and 3pm on the 21st of June. Scrolling down, the development does not meet performance criteria 10.4.2p3. The site and scale of the dwelling must not cause unreasonable loss of amenity by overshadowing the private open space of a dwelling on an adjoining lot, or visual impacts caused by the apparent scale, bulk or proportions of the dwelling when viewed from an adjoining lot. And B, provide separation between dwellings on adjoining lots that is compatible with that prevailing in the surrounding area. I think that's a critical point. In conclusion, we need to be encouraging higher density in urban areas to meet the needs of a growing population. We all agree with that. In some areas, this will mean multi-storey buildings, perhaps at Kingston Park. In other areas, this will mean apartment blocks right up to the edge of the setback. In other areas still, it will mean multiple units where once there was a single residential home. We all agree with that. However, the discretion still applies. It is not the case that just because we need more housing in Kingborough that we should be putting 5 units on every block when it may be more appropriate to have 3 or 4 units on that block instead. If it were the case that every block should have the maximum number of dwellings that we could possibly cram on it, then we would do away with the planning scheme, we do away with the zone purpose statements, we do away with the future character statements altogether and allow any block to have any building and any number of buildings on it. This proposal will, in fact, impact neighbourhood amenity. It will cause overshadowing and it doesn't comply with P3 performance criteria on page 9A, 2, 4 and B, as they relate to overshadowing of private open space, visual impact and separation between dwellings on adjoining properties, subclauses at 10.4.283. Similarly, the proposal does not comply with 10.4.683B. It has been acknowledged in the report that this proposal will impact on adjacent properties, and therefore it's my opinion that those impacts are unreasonable, and that's why I'll be voting against it. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on my list, I have Councillor Westwood and then Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. I have a question which is also in relation to what we can see in Figure 3 of the 36 Power Road adjoining 32 Tolone Road and part of the DA requesting the removal of the tree at 32 Tolone Road. I haven't seen this before. I'd actually assumed it must have been the same owner of both properties. How can someone put in a development application, which I support, for 5 units at 36 Power Road, but also apply to remove a tree on someone else's land?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. As far as the planning application process is concerned, anybody can make an application for anything on anybody's property, basically. In terms of being able to carry out that development, if it were to be approved, they would still require the consent of the owners. So they wouldn't be able to just remove that tree without the consent of the owner at the time that they were doing those works.
So if this is approved tonight and the owners of 32 Tolone Road don't agree to that tree being removed, what happens then?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. In effect, that would be a matter for the owners to negotiate, but if the consent wasn't forthcoming, then they would have to look at probably redesigning their development to be able to retain that tree.
Okay, thank you.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. Just when you think you've got this planning scheme, there is so much to learn. And I always come to this with an open mind. Truly, I say that. And I did drive around and have a look at that site and noted that there is a lot of high-density development around that area, and that versus going into farmland and, removing a lot more high-conservation trees. Councillor Cordova did raise some very important points, and I guess the things that had queried in my mind was the shadowing, that 9 to 11am, doesn't like a bit of sunshine in the morning, and I think about that urban amenity and that livability sentiments that come to mind. I just guess I'm wanting to unpack that a bit more, or how can we make that decision that the 9 to 11 overshadowing is okay to not allow sunlight in that dwelling?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. So in relation to the overshadowing, it's a generally sort of accepted rule that between 9am and 3pm on June 21st is the sort of important time, if you like, for the extent of shadowing. It is, again, reasonably well sort of accepted within planning that if you get a minimum of 3 hours, that between those hours, then that is generally acceptable. I think that probably the important thing to recognise here is that units 1 to 4 are fully contained within the building envelope. Unit 5 is the only unit that is outside the building envelope. So if you look at the extent of the shadowing from unit 5, then I think the impacts, as far as particularly in relation to the property at 38 Power Road, the shadowing caused by unit 5 would actually not reach that property. So the shadow, particularly between 9 and 11, the biggest extent of shadow comes from Unit 2, which is fully contained within the building envelope, so that effectively is not triggering that performance criteria. The other thing is that there is obviously at 9 o'clock there's a reasonable amount of shadow, and at 10 o'clock, but by 11 o'clock that private open space area is pretty much free of shadow, and then it obviously has northern sun at lunchtime, gets into that area as well, and then it would have afternoon sun. So it's quite reasonable in terms of the level of impact for a residential area.
Thank you. I know this has been talked about before. There's nothing in the planning scheme we can do in regards to the amount of concrete that will potentially be used in this type of development. And is that correct?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. Effectively, yes. There was previously provisions in the planning scheme requiring a minimum of 25% of the site being free of impervious surfaces. That provision was removed through PD8, so there are no provisions in relation to the scheme to control that. From our point of view, we certainly do push developers to try to include as much landscaping and reduce the hard surfaces as much as possible, but obviously there is a requirement to provide parking and manoeuvring on site, which does control how much hard stand is required.
Thank you. In relation to the parking, and again, I know we have to assess this on its own and not to the potential growth and this whole street becoming a 5-unit dwelling on every block, but seeing other streets around Kingborough, noting there's only 2 visitor car parks, I guess that meets performance criteria. That's correct.
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. It actually meets the acceptable solution rather than it doesn't rely on performance criteria. So the requirement for parking is 2 parking spaces per dwelling for dwellings with 2 or more bedrooms, plus 1 visitor parking space per 4 units. So in this case, each unit has 2 parking spaces. So the units 1 to 4 have a single garage plus an open parking space each. Unit 5 has a double garage, and then there are 2 visitor parking spaces, which meets the requirements of 1 per 4 dwellings. So it satisfies the acceptable solution.
Thank you. Sorry, it was more related to the visitor car parking. And just note, and there's nothing we can do in regards to assessing that against the potential growth of that street, where in 5 years' time, if there is more increased development in that area, we might see just that street becoming a car parking mess.
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. We can only assess each application on its own merits, and in this particular case, this application meets the requirements of the planning scheme.
Thank you. And there's nothing at all in regards to footpath contribution?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. There's nothing in the planning scheme that requires the provisions of footpaths in relation to a development of this nature.
Thank you. And just noting there is the Blue Gum High Conservation stating that it will not be impacted and there are measures in place to protect it. I'm sure there'll be a lot of community sentiment around to make sure that that actually is protected as part of this development.
Thank you. Councillor Fox.
Oh, I just want to say how much I appreciate the previous two speakers and what they've said and how much work they've done into presenting their arguments. I've had all of those concerns, and I find it appalling that I used to live there when I was a little girl in that area, across the road in fact. The change that's happening and how the local residents are so resistant to this type of change. But I, at the same time, I'm very concerned that the changes in the planning scheme, the trend of multi-unit dwellings in this area, it's going to concern the residents, it's going to upset everyone, but I really can't see that as a council, we're wearing a planning hat, that we can refuse it. I just want to record my concerns, my appreciation of the sentiments in the community, and also from my fellow councillors and how they've expressed them. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Are there any further speakers? I guess just for my contribution, I wanted to come back to Councillor Cordova talked about the submission that Kimberley Council made back in May 2021 in relation to what was then a draft PD8. And yes, we did put forward a four-page submission, and we had some concerns about some of the things that were being presented in that. But ultimately, the state government went in a direction which, you know, largely we didn't agree with. The difficulty that we now have in sitting as a planning authority is that just because we didn't endorse that, you know, the aspect of it about the building envelope or the rear setback or the permeability of surfaces, that doesn't change the fact that we have to still assess this against the planning scheme now. It has passed that test, and so we are in that difficult situation where we're not allowed to have that opinion about it in terms of whether we like it or not. And we do accept, as Councillor Cordova has mentioned, that infill housing is something that is going to be very much part of the future of this community. And in fact, we did all sign off, I think, unanimously on the Urban Growth Plan, formerly known as the Metro Plan, and that did identify Blackmans Bay as another urban growth area where infill housing was going to be located, because there is not enough land supply in Kingston to satisfy the demand. And even when you add Blackmans Bay, the population increases that we've just seen in the census of us going over 40,000 people indicate that we're going to have a serious supply shortage if our population does continue at the rate that it is. So I have accepted the advice of our expert planning staff, and I will be supporting this, but I do respect that there are some neighbours that are not happy with it, but it has been assessed and we need to support it. So who moved this? Beg your pardon. It was moved by Councillor Glade-Wright. Did you want to sum up? No? Okay, so I'm going to put the motion. It was moved by Councillor Glade-Wright and seconded by Councillor Street. It was the recommendation is as printed, starts on page 17 and continues over to page 22. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? I'll have a show of hands, please. All those in favour is Councillors Wass, Midgley, Glade-Wright, Fox, Street, Bastone, Westwood and Reed. And those against, Councillor Cordova, the motion is carried. The Planning Authority of Council now adjourns at 6:18 p.m. The open session of Council now commences at 6:18 p.m. Turning now to page 78, petitions still being actioned. There were no petitions still being actioned, and at the time the agenda was compiled, there were no additional petitions that had been received. Still on page 78, officers report to Council, biodiversity offset policy review, with a recommendation on page 83 from mover in Councillor Westwood, seconder in Councillor Fox. Councillor Westwood.
Thank you, Mayor. We have before us consideration of Council's biodiversity offset policy. This is a 5-year review. The policy was endorsed by Council originally back in 2010, reviewed again in 2016, and is now due for, or overdue for, its 5-year review from there. Just as a little bit of background, biodiversity offsets are defined as measures that compensate for the residual adverse impacts of an action on the environment when alternatives and options to avoid those impacts have been exhausted and it is still considered desirable for other economic, social or environmental reasons for the action to proceed. So for me, that is probably the most pertinent point in relation to this policy. Since the introduction of the policy, as part of our Kingborough Environmental Fund, we've received over $1 million in financial offsets. A summary from staff, the current review has found that the current approach to offsets has been working well, with over 150 hectares of threatened vegetation and threatened species habitat protected directly through on-site offsets under Part 5 agreements and more than 22 hectares transferred to Council as bushland reserves. A further 9.5 hectares has been protected off-site through Part 5 agreements, 12 hectares off-site protected through a conservation covenant, and more than 1.9 hectares has been restored in priority areas. So the assessment of staff is that the direct protection of such values is an effective and important result of the biodiversity offset policy, and all indications are that the policy is working well. There are a number of amendments that are proposed as part of this review. One of them relates to financial offsets, which have been increased from $500 to $570 per tree of very high conservation value and up to $340 for high conservation value as identified in Table 2, which we have as part of our report. $13,650 per hectare of high and moderate biodiversity values, as identified in Table 3 of our report. And just to note that these offsets are inclusive of an administration fee and are reviewed periodically in conjunction with the policy.
Thank you. Councillor Westwood, further speakers? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm going to start with some questions and then I'll do my substantive, and it's very carefully timed. So let me start by thanking the author and the authoriser of the report and sincerely express my gratitude for their impressive work. My first question is clause 2.8.4 on, it's page 96 of our agenda, but it's page 2 of the policy. So looking at page 96, it defines a special circumstance where development that may justify reduction in biodiversity may include the development is located on an existing title for a single dwelling and or associated outbuilding. And so I note that 6.13 explains that a financial offset may only be used where there's no opportunity for on-site or off-site offsets. However, basically my question is, please explain what clause 2.8.4 means. Does it mean that all development that occurs on a single dwelling title will automatically be considered eligible to use a financial offset under the biodiversity policy if they can't find space on-site or off-site? Or is clause 2.8.4 still discretionary as to whether or not it counts as a special circumstance?
Ms. Dennexter?
Through you, Mayor. I just want to double check I understand the question. So if a development meets 2.84, it will count as a special circumstance. Mm-hmm. And then it may or may not be a financial contribution or an on-site or off-site offset, depending on what capacity there is on that site and what alternatives there are off-site. So all the special circumstances doing is allowing it to proceed to consideration of an offset. So if you don't meet any of the special circumstances, offsets are off the table altogether. Mm-hmm. But if you meet one of those, including 2.84, then we look to what the appropriate offset is in that particular circumstance and whether it's financial or in situ or off-site conservation, on-site or off-site.
Thank you. Further to that, I'm trying to figure out why 2.84 is in there. When I initially read it, I kind of thought, oh, that means anyone with a single dwelling title is kind of gets special treatment. And
But am I misinterpreting that?
Not really. The intention is that if there is an existing title and its zoning allows for a residential development, that it's reasonable for them to be considered against the rest of the tests and not be precluded because it doesn't meet one, two or three. It's not going to be important socially and economically, so it can't meet one as a special circumstance. Number two is whether the values are really, really poor condition, so it may not meet that. And three is designed for sites where you do have enough elsewhere on the site and you're only having a small impact. So we didn't have that special circumstance two policies ago and a planning scheme ago, and it resulted in some blocks being undevelopable, and it was our view that that wasn't reasonable, that those people should have the opportunity to build a single dwelling on those properties if they offset that impact.
Thank you. That's a really important point, and thanks for that clarification. Number two, my second question, clause 6.9. So I'm now looking at page 98, and I'm looking at clause 6.9. Clause 6.9 details the offsetting plan for recipient land, and it reads, quote, management actions for the first 5 years of implementing the conservation management plan must be costed and bonded. Ongoing management is the responsibility of the landowner or manager and must be undertaken in accordance with the conservation management plan. So my question is, let's take the example of somebody removing a 60-year-old Eucalyptus viminalis, potential habitat for the swift parrot. The developer chooses option A, to have an on-site conservation covenant. The replacement value here is to put six viminalis tube stock or seedlings into the ground to replace that lost 60-year-old tree with nesting hollows. Is it true that clause 6.9 means that only the first 5 years of that 60-year process are actually costed and bonded, and then after 5 years it's up to the landowner-manager for the next 55 years to just do the right thing and follow the conservation management plan? Is council confident in taking developers at their word that they'll act in good faith by maintaining the offset for the full life of the replacement tree?
Ms. Dinexter.
Through you, Mayor. So revegetation as an offset option isn't available as the only offset option. So if somebody wants to include revegetation in their offset, it has to be part of a package and complement the broader protection. So it would be a very small component. So we would have to be satisfied that the rest of the offset was achieving the outcome, and the revegetation was just a bonus, if you like. The only real opportunities where the revegetation is the entirety of the offset is through the payment of the financial contribution, and then the responsibility comes to council for monitoring that, for the very reasons that you've pointed out. The reality of people planting trees and maintaining them in perpetuity and us monitoring that, it's not feasible and it's not realistic, which is why it's not on the table as an appropriate offset in and of itself. The five-year management actions, I can't think of any apart from some large subdivisions like Spring Farm, where there has been a component of revegetation and the land that's been revegetated is transferred to council, and so we are taking it on beyond that 5 years in those situations. But for private land, it hasn't and isn't used as an option within the policy framework.
Thank you. Yeah, I can see that it's great when council takes it over. That means that in perpetuity we can protect it. But wouldn't it have been better to write that clause as being that they'll maintain it in perpetuity? Like, why did we choose 5 years? Why didn't we choose 10 or 20, or, as I would have liked, choose 100 years?
The obligation is in perpetuity. The management for bonding and costing is simply an obligation to report to us and show us that each year the trees or the actions are established. So usually 5 years is enough time to get something to care and maintenance, so the weed control has been undertaken and all the primary weeds are in hand and it's just checking. So beyond that 5 years, the obligation is absolutely there to continue protecting what it is that they've committed to protecting. We're not holding their hand in the same way, and it's not bonded.
Thank you. My final question is in Table 3. This is page 102 of our council agenda, Table 3. The final asterisk at the very bottom of Table 3 reads, quote, where the recipient land contains additional values to the area being impacted, the offset ratio may be reduced
at the discretion of council. My question is, under what circumstances might council reduce the offset? Are there any examples that we can think of? And does it mean, as I fear, that if you have recipient land in your possession that's already good habitat, that your offsetting can be less? We're seeing these a lot with carbon offsets, where people are taking land that they already own that they had no intention of damaging and using that as kind of double dipping. They're using land that they were never going to knock the trees over on as an offset, and they're actually getting paid for that in the case of carbon banking. So my question is, does it not contradict clause 6.6, where an offset proposal is only considered where there are no existing protections and it's not part of an existing natural reserve area? My concern is about people saying that they're going to protect land that's already protected, or protecting land that they had no intention of damaging and then saying, well, now I get a reduced offset because I own this bush block over here. I was never going to touch it, but that counts as my offset, so now I don't have to plant as many tube stock.
Stan Exton.
Through you, Mayor. You do highlight a dilemma and a challenge. There is a risk that the way rules are structured can sometimes reward poor management. So if something's in poorer condition, its offset will be less. And what this is acknowledging is if something's in really good condition compared to what's being impacted, or its conservation value is much higher, so say its threat status is endangered instead of rare, they may be able to provide a reduced area in offset. So I can think of two examples. One is quite a long time ago, so it was the Bluebush Crescent development at Blackmans Bay. That's actually our only example, well, one of two examples actually, of off-site offsets. So the offset for that was at Wingara Road. And at the time, their ratio was reduced by both Council and the Forest Practices Authority. That was a joint regulatory process then. The actual area required to be protected was reduced because the condition of the values that were being protected in that Part 5 agreement were much better than what was being impacted. What was being impacted was quite poor condition, so that was recognised and the area protected was allowed to be reduced in area. The other example is Algona Road, so the ratio was slightly reduced because what they were protecting within that site was in much, much better condition and had a lot greater diversity than the area impacted. In terms of whether that's double dipping, something isn't accepted or considered protected until it actually has a status under either the Land Use Planning Act or the Nature Conservation Act or in public ownership. So it would and then we wouldn't accept it as an offset. So I don't think there's a risk of double dipping, but certainly there might be some savvy people out there that, you know, do potentially, you know, perhaps not manage their land as well as they could and get rewarded for that by having a lower offset, or they could be sitting on some land that's a great offset. And if that's the case, we still get the conservation outcome. It's a tricky one because the planning scheme doesn't regulate use in the context of these values. It only regulates development. So we have very little control over whether somebody's perhaps overgrazing, overburning, not managing their weeds.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I really do appreciate the amazing work of our Natural Areas Biodiversity team. It's important work, and our council is very lucky to have such passionate and diligent staff to undertake it. Here goes my substantive contribution, Mayor, if you please. Biodiversity offsets are measures that compensate for residual impacts when alternatives have been exhausted. The aim is to, and this is from most desirable to least desirable, to minimise, to mitigate, and then as a last resort to use offsets, and direct offsets are the most desirable. That is Part 5 agreements, conservation covenants, bushland reserves, on-site restoration, on-site rehabilitation. Now, I recognise that these offsets we're talking about are a last resort, and I've been told that biodiversity offsets are designed to offset lost habitat, and they're not designed to be a penalty or a disincentive for developers. And I've been told that not all developers are created equal. Some are large cap investors that can afford to pay, while others are small cap developers
developers who can't afford to pay. And I fundamentally believe that offsetting for biodiversity loss and disincentivising developers for destroying Kingborough's precious habitat are not mutually exclusive quantities. We can have both at the same time, and I propose that we should. I think we need to differentiate between the size of a developer, so a large institutional developer may need to pay more than a mum and dad building a shed or something. Similarly, we need to account for the time lost in growing a tree to a suitable size to become valuable habitat. When a developer removes an 80-year-old blue gum with nesting hollows, replacing that Eucalyptus biminalis with six seedlings from the nursery just doesn't cut the mustard, in my opinion. I believe we're currently setting our sights too low, and we're compromised by a tyranny of low expectations. Specifically, in Clause 6.15, Table 1, offsetting options, in subclause C, this is the financial offsets, and you can see it on page 99 of our agenda. The biodiversity policy proposes a maximum financial offset of up to $570 per tree of very high conservation value. This is a very fancy way of saying that Kingborough Council is significantly undervaluing our high conservation value trees. Meanwhile, other jurisdictions properly value the social, economic, health and wellbeing and ecosystem services that high conservation value trees offer. The median house price in Kingston is now $829,000, with many suburbs in Kingborough, whether it's Taroona, Tinderbox, Kingston Beach or Blackmans Bay, now closing in on $1 million median house price. So this policy is saying loud and clear that in Kingborough, we value our very high conservation value trees at a rate of about 1/5,000th of a median house. We think a 100-year-old tree with nesting hollows could be worth as much to our ecosystem as nearly half of 0.1% of the house that is replacing it. A 100-year-old tree in return for six seedlings from a nursery is not good enough. You can read about it on page 33 of the Hobart City Council Street Tree Strategy, and I quote, "The City of Melbourne assigns a base value relative to the width of the trunk at breast height and applies a multiplier thereafter for species, aesthetics, locality and condition. In one widely publicised case, the City of Melbourne demanded an inner-city developer pay $62,500 per tree to replace four trees removed during the remodelling of their premises." And that is exactly why I would like to move an amendment, and this amendment is to Table 1, Option C, Financial Offsets, to read: financial offsets are calculated at a rate of up to $5,700 per tree of very high conservation value and up to $3,400 for high conservation value trees as identified in Table 2, or $136,500 per hectare of high and moderate biodiversity value as identified and subject to the replacement ratios in Table 3. The third dot point would read: these financial offsets are indexed annually to the Consumer Price Index, are inclusive of a 20% administration fee, and are reviewed periodically in conjunction with the policy. And finally, an applicant may be eligible for consideration for hardship assistance in accordance with Council's Financial Hardship Policy 1.18. So the amendment, in layman's terms, is to times by 10 the amount that is currently suggested. It's to times it by 10, but crucially, it is to adjust it to inflation, and it's also to add in a hardship clause. And the genius of this is that, well, genius is a strong word. The important aspect of this is that people who can't afford it can utilise Council's hardship provisions, but people who can afford it will have to pay for the trees they knock over. So that's the amendment I'm moving, and I'm seeking a seconder for that, if I may.
Seconded, Councillor Midgley. Okay, so we're now debating the amendment. Did you want to say anything further on that?
I do. Thank you, Mayor. The City of Melbourne uses a much more robust framework for valuing trees. Biodiversity offsets are a last resort, so it is unusual for these offsets to be called into use. However, when they are called into use, financial offsets, they should be so significant that everyone is clear that they have to do their utmost to avoid using those financial offsets. Offsets are a last resort, and by having real monetary disincentives, it will avoid developers using offsets as a first resort. It will avoid them from using it as just a cost of doing business. Everybody agrees, I think, that for a major developer with $100 million, $570 a tree is just not a lot. It's a cost of doing business. But we know that some people are not wealthy developers. Some people are just regular households. And so for those people,
there is a provision under our hardship policy, which already exists, for the general manager, the chief financial officer or the manager of finance to use their discretion in accordance with our council's financial hardship policy to ensure that those small cap developers are not slugged with the same costs as big time subdivisions. Critically, the procedure policy detail of the financial hardship policy reads, 5.1, a ratepayer may be eligible for consideration for hardship assistance in the payment of rates, service charges, interest and penalties, where the person is unable to pay their charges when due or payable for reasons beyond their control, or 5.1.2, payment would cause the person hardship. So it's basically at the discretion of the general manager or the manager of finance or the chief financial officer. We can recognise when a ratepayer will face financial hardship, and our policy on financial hardship explains what evidence and is required, but it also explains, you know, the privacy around that. We have the capacity to ensure that those who can afford to pay and those who can't afford to pay can utilise the provisions of the hardship policy. Critically, it will help incentivise developers large and small to consider carefully their options before going down the road of a financial offset. Remember, the ideal situation is to avoid, minimise, and then, as a last resort, to offset. The most desirable outcome is to avoid habitat loss in the first place. But where none of this can be achieved, there must be a significant disincentive from just chopping it down, throwing some coins into the offset jar. And my amendment will make financial offsets a last resort, not an easy way out. By utilising our existing financial hardship policy, no councillor can make the claim that we are unfairly burdening developers. My understanding is that our financial assistance policy is in line with Legat's financial hardship policy model, which has a clear set of principles, which include consistent, equitable and respectful treatment for all residents and ratepayers that's sensitive to their specific circumstances, assisting ratepayers who are suffering serious financial hardships so that they may overcome those circumstances and return to financial stability, ensure that those who are able to contribute to local services continue to do so, and minimising the opportunity for misuse, exploitation or fraud by ensuring decisions made to provide special relief or assistance are supported by sufficient evidence, and finally, maintaining confidentiality and privacy. So my amendment seeks to achieve three things: to ensure that we use this biodiversity financial offset as a last resort, and that all feasible options in the hierarchy minimise and mitigate impacts have actually been exhausted before we use them. Secondly, to introduce sufficient flexibility to the policy to ensure that those who can afford to pay do. And finally, to ensure that the quantum of the offset is indexed to keep pace with inflation. Yeah. I urge you all to support my amendment. Thank you.
The General Manager just wanted to add something in relation to the hardship policy.
Yep. Thank you, Mayor, and through you. Councillor Cordova, the dilemma that I have is that the final dot point of your amendment is at odds with the wording of the current financial policy that Council has in place.
He just asked how. I'll just interpret for you.
Yep, through you, Mayor. If I can just read it out, councillors. It currently says that a ratepayer may be eligible for consideration for hardship assistance in the payment of rates, service charges, interest and penalties.
Sorry, is this a service charge? My interpretation is that this is a service charge or a penalty. A financial offset would be a service charge or a penalty.
Not when you read the policy.
Through you, Mayor, I don't believe Council's financial hardship policy had the offset policy in mind when it was prepared, and that's not how I interpret it, Councillor Cordova.
So my question would be, if, through you, Mayor, if it's not a service fee, if it's not a penalty, if it's not a fee, a fine or a charge, what is the financial offset? It's a monetary payment to Council. What is it, if not what's listed in that financial hardship policy? And is it not true that the intention of the policy is to be a catch-all for any fee, fine or service charge? What is the charge?
Through you, Mayor, if I may. The financial offset policy is designed for those ratepayers finding themselves in times of hardship in relation to the payment of their rates. And I can only repeat what I said a few minutes ago, Councillor Cordova. It's not how I interpret the policy. Councillors may beg to differ.
Thank you. And just a procedural question through you, Mayor. Can we, by amending this policy, I assume that we can't at the same time
amend the financial policy. And so, but I think my question still stands that if, my question remains, what is this charge if it's not a service charge? What is it?
Ms. Vanex.
Through you, Mayor, the way I would describe it is it's a contribution that's required to satisfy the planning scheme. So another example is a public open space policy, public open space contribution, and I can't imagine that the hardship policy would be utilised to sidestep a public open space contribution for a subdivision, for example. So I'm not clear how it could be used in the case of the offset policy either.
Thank you. So through you, Mayor, I think in light of this advice, the most prudent way forward, I think, would be to strike the fourth dot point and then debate the amendment on its merits without that fourth dot point.
Okay, so your amendment now is just the three dot points, so...
Unless, I'm reading the room now, unless other people agree with my interpretation that it's a fee or a charge rather than the general manager's interpretation, which is it's a contribution.
Well, you can't actually take a straw poll right now of that. You need to either withdraw it and move on, otherwise it's going to be a really long night.
I will... I'll remove it, because we want to save trees in Kingborough, so...
Okay, so Mrs. Morton, could you just please remove that last dot point so we can be clear? Who seconded the... Councillor Midgley, do you agree with that? Thank you. Okay, all right, can we get back to... I think your time might be up, Councillor Cordova. Any further speakers? Now we're speaking on the amendment. Councillor Street, then Councillor Midgley, and anyone else after that?
I have a question, Mayor. And I'm going to do my best not to load it.
Thank you.
Are those amounts in the amended wording proportionate to the cost of offsetting the biodiversity values that are described in the policy?
Anybody? Ms. Quinn.
Through you, Mayor. No, I don't believe they are generally. So, of course, the offset policy needs to generalise. We've got categories of conservation significance, but, of course, they're generalised across all of the vegetation communities and different threatened species. So we can only really speak in generalisations about do they compensate. But I would say in doing the work as part of the review, we did review what it costs to actually obtain the values that are lost in Kingborough generally through development, and that's how we came up with the figures in the current report.
Thank you, Mayor. I'll keep my remarks on this pretty brief because I do think that this is yet another example of Councillor Cordova's version of perfect getting in the way of the good, which is that I think that we have a good biodiversity offset policy, and I do genuinely believe that. We're one of few council areas that I'm aware of anywhere that have such a policy of this kind, and I think that that is a good thing. But what Councillor Cordova's amendment seeks to do is poke developers and our ratepayers in the eye, disincentivise development, disincentivise the type of development that this municipality needs, and take an amount of money which is completely disproportionate to the offsets required to support the important biodiversity values that this policy seeks to protect. I couldn't possibly support it, and like I said, I simply think that we're letting a particular version of perfect get in the way of what is otherwise a very good policy. And I would urge my council colleagues not to allow such grandstanding to continue.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. Well, I support the amendment. I think it's important to have this discussion. And thanks, Councillor Street, for asking those questions. Councillor Cordova has raised many important points. It's good to have it open and transparent. We know the mum and mum developer versus the major developer, there is a big difference in regards to what they make out of their development. So I think it is an important thing to open up and put that on the floor and have that discussion. And if not now, then perhaps in the future, if it doesn't get passed tonight, we can actually take that into consideration, the difference between smaller developers and larger developers. Trees are a valuable community and public asset, and they're a valuable asset for wildlife, and many people in Kingborough move here, live here, for the value of the trees and the environment and the beauty that they do bring. So I thank Councillor Cordova for putting this on the table and bringing this to discussion before us tonight.
Thank you. Further speakers? On the just to clarify, we're on the amendment. Okay, if not, I'll say some words on the amendment. Oh, Councillor Fox.
I guess I'm cognizant of the workshop that we had, and we were reassured that we're being very fair in what we are charging in terms of what we're protecting. And even though I think in an ideal world, I'd love to charge a lot more for the vegetation that we are losing in Kingborough, but as has been said, it's important that we keep things realistic, and we can also review it on a regular basis. So if we feel we can charge more and there are more things we can do and we've got more people to do the work, then we can always raise that amount. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Bestone.
Thank you. I support the amendment mostly because I think we have to really value our trees. I went to a nursery at the weekend. We're doing extensive planting at our place. The trees we were looking at were between $3,000 and $5,000 each. That was to buy from the nursery. And they were not particularly high conservation trees. They were just largish trees. Now, it might sound an awful lot of money, but that's what trees cost. That's without worrying about the good they're doing. That's what it costs to replace a big tree. So, you know, $570 gets you a tree in a 20-litre container. It's just ridiculous that we would only charge that amount of money.
Thank you, Councillor Bastone. Councillor Midgley, did you have a question?
Yes, I do, Mayor. I do have a question. In regards to point... the one around the indexed, which point is that? Why can't I just see it? Point three. I'm correct to note that that's actually not in the other policy. Is that in the policy? It is table three, is it? Sorry. Page. Does it say that exact wording? Sorry, I'm just trying to find the page for that one. Councillor Glade Wright's finding the page.
I can make my contribution while you're trying to find it. How about that?
Page, okay, thank you.
Do you want to ask your question? Okay, all right. Look, I really valued the workshop that we had on this back on the 25th of July because I think it clarified a lot of things for me. You may recall that I brought the original notice of motion suggesting that we get a report on increasing the biodiversity offsets. And initially, when I saw that, I thought we haven't gone far enough. But I thought we had a really productive conversation at the workshop about the fact that our staff, who of course are experts in this area, had looked at both national and international models. They looked at the size of our market here, and they came to the conclusion that what we're doing at the moment is working really well. And of course, for we've talked about the fund and all the work that the fund has been doing. But the key takeaway for me from that was it's not realistic to copy a policy that is in Melbourne or Sydney or a large capital city where the market is very, very different. And bearing in mind, the state government doesn't do offsets either. The Hobart City Council doesn't do offsets. We need to remember that there is a range of things here from the individuals through to large-scale developers. But I don't think that we have the expertise, and based on the advice we're given by those who do, we've been told that the rate is probably at the point that it should be, that it covers the costs that we have, and we can achieve protection the way it is at the moment. And that was the key point, I think, from the staff when we questioned, could you make it more? Should we make it more? And they said, why do you need to make it more when we're achieving the protection at the moment? And I thought they were really wise words. We were also told, and I think it might have been Ms Quinn who said this, we don't want to put a fee on development so that we're paying for approval, not an outcome. And I think that's very important as well. You know, we can't... yes, we all who are sitting around this table acknowledge that trees are valuable and we don't want to be cutting them down because a developer has a whim. But there is a hierarchy, and we saw that triangle of the hierarchy, and these are things that are done as a last resort. And so if we can have a system where we work with developers and they're willing to, rather than us waving a big stick and saying, well, you've got to give us $130,000 if you want to cut down that tree or that group of trees, surely we could have a more productive outcome and a better outcome for the environment if we go down that path. So I think this is one of these cases where we need to have a balance, and I believe that our staff have given us advice about what that balance should be, and I would really like to see us accept that. Councillor Cordova,
just a question, please. Yeah, two questions. My first question is actually about that inflation, the CPI. My understanding, and the reason why I put in this dot point about indexing it to CPI, my understanding is the reason why we're raising the rate from 500 to 570 is to adjust for the inflation between when we invented this fee or contribution to now, but my belief is that it's not indexed to inflation going forward. So all we have as a provision is just to update this periodically, but my amendment is actually making it annually indexed to CPI. So can we just hear some clarity about whether or not this policy as it stands is annually indexed to adjust for inflation?
Ms Quinn.
Through you, Mayor, no, it's not.
Just bear in mind that as a council we have the opportunity to ask for the policy to be reviewed at any time, not just for when it's due for renewal in another 5 years. So
that's true. Yep. Thank you. And the second question is, do I get a right of reply for the amendment?
That's what I was about to ask you to do before you threw a question.
Perfect. Thank you so much. So why do we need to achieve more when we're achieving all we want to achieve at the moment? A central question, and I think we're not achieving enough. We have here in Kingborough two bird species that I can think of, swift parrot and 40-spotted pardalote, for which they're more rare than a white rhino or a giant panda, and yet apparently we're reaching our goals. I think our goals need to be a bit more lofty. So this debate came down to whether it's the perfect getting in the way of the good, and it came down to a definition, sadly, of a financial offset being a contribution as opposed to being a service charge. I tried to add in a clause about financial hardship. The City of Melbourne is happily charging people who can afford it when they do knock over high conservation value trees. And as I mentioned in my substantive, the median house price in Kingborough is $1 million. It's near closing in on $1 million now. So I think the time where we can say little old Tassie is different from the mainland is that time has passed now. We're talking about big developers, big subdivisions that take place where $570 per tree is just a cost of doing business. And Councillor Bastone was absolutely right that you couldn't buy a 20-litre pot with a big tree in it for $570, and yet we're supposed to believe that a 100-year-old Viminalis is only worth $570. It doesn't pass the pub test. We should have had a fourth dot point in here to talk about a hardship clause to differentiate between high-cap subdivision developers versus small developers, whether it's by using our existing financial hardship policy or indeed inventing a new one that is bespoke for the biodiversity offset policy. But the fact remains that right now we're not charging enough for trees, and there are people who are laughing all the way to the bank because this is a cost of doing business as they knock over precious biodiversity habitat in our municipality. And the question then becomes, who are we supposed to believe? Are we supposed to believe our own eyes, where so many people, we've heard from Councillor Fox today talk about Blackmans Bay and the changes there? Are we supposed to believe that we're meeting all of our goals, or are we supposed to believe our own eyes, where we're constantly seeing these high conservation value trees getting knocked over throughout our municipality? And the proof is in the pudding that we've had over $1 million go into that offset account. $1 million represents hundreds upon hundreds, thousands of trees getting knocked over for $500 a piece. As you can tell from the community outreach about tree protection that we've had throughout my years on this council, I hope that after the upcoming local government elections in October, we will have a council with the political will to vastly improve this vision for tree retention and preservation in Kingborough. I'd like to see a council with a grand vision for protecting habitat, restoring and rehabilitating more vegetation communities, and actively disincentivising developers, both large and small, from taking unnecessary steps that they don't need to take. They should be building around, building with, building in harmony with nature, not building in contravention of it and destroying our precious biodiversity. And we will all be on record tonight when we vote for this amendment about whether or not we think trees are worth more than $570 a pop. And I think the community will judge us accordingly. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. So I'm going to put the amendment now. The amendment was moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour of the amendment? Against? No. Okay, show of hands. All those in favour of the amendment? Is Councillors Cordova, Midgley and Bastone? Those against? Is Councillors Wass, Gladewright, Fox, Street, Westwood and Reet? The amendment is lost. We're back on the substantial motion, but I think most people have spoken on the substantial motion. No? Councillor Midgley, did you want to speak on the substantial? If you haven't spoken on the substantial motion, now's your time. I did have you on the list, but... No? Okay, off you go then.
Thank you. I have just a question, Mayor. So in regards to that, I liked that the clause there that was added in regards to the CPI, noting on page 99, thank you, Councillor Gladewright, C, that the previous amendment had these financial offsets are inclusive of 20%, but it had the indexed annually to the CPI. So these financial offsets are indexed annually to the CPI. I'm wondering staff's response in regards to perhaps including that, and if so, I could move an amendment to include that in the policy.
Ms. Quinn.
Through you, Mayor. Yes, we could consider a much more regular review of the rates in terms of CPI. I don't know if Council does that to similar... I guess we would review the rates and charges every year, so potentially it could be done at the same time, but probably need to seek advice from someone about whether we could do that.
Why am I looking at Mr. Breen all of a sudden? I can see his mind ticking over. Anyone? Anyone? General Manager?
I guess just to ask a further question on that, because it was quite a while before this policy was actually reviewed, and so that 500 or whatever it was before that sat there for how many years?
Six, was it? Or longer?
About 5 years.
Thank you.
5 years. And so if therefore that then was a CPI... Who's our mathematician accountant here? If that was indexed during that time, the 5 years, I don't know, what would that, I guess, what, you know, putting out there,
General
what would
Manager
that have been?
Knows the answer
then
to this.
Through you, Mayor. Councillor Midgley, the Hobart CPI index taken at the March quarter every year for the last 8 years has averaged 2.41%. So if we work on a five-year basis for this particular update at 2.41%, I think the $570, for example, the $70 increase is in keeping with that, notwithstanding that the CPI, as we all know, can fluctuate dramatically at times. But over the last 8 years, it has averaged 2.41%.
Thank you for that clarification. Well, I guess then it will be, yeah, I don't think required, but it would be good to review this more rather than every sort of 5 years. That would be good. So how could we keep that then on the agenda to perhaps review it closer to the time than perhaps
come back with a notice of motion next year?
Who is on council then? I hope that they can do that.
That would be more appropriate than making up amendments on the run tonight so that we can make sure we get them right.
Sorry, through you, Mayor, just a question. Don't we update annually our schedule of rates and charges? Our fees, rates and charges does go up indexed to CPI annually.
It does, but we've decided that this is not a fee and charge.
No, it's a contribution.
So it wouldn't be part of that. So if there was to be a further amendment, it would need to come via a notice of motion at a later time. Okay. Any more contributions on the substantive motion? If not, I'm going to put the substantive motion. Going back, it's as printed on the screen, A, B, C and D. It was moved by Councillor Westwood and seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour? Against? Okay, show of hands is required. All those in favour is Councillors Wass, Midgley, Gladewright, Fox, Street, Bastone, Westwood and Reet, and those against, Councillor Cordova, the motion is carried. It's just after 7 o'clock. I did foreshadow in an email to everyone early this afternoon that we would stop and have a bit of a comfort / quick dinner break now. If we can be back here by no later than 20 past seven, we've still got quite a bit to get through on the agenda, but I think there's something we can eat in the General Manager's office. That's not his plans. There you go, I've forgotten what I'm doing. Okay, welcome back. Thank you for those who are watching at home for your patience. We just needed a bit of a comfort break there. It's going to be a long evening, I think. We are now on page 104 with a recommendation on page 105, and it's the Kingborough Awards Policy. Do I have a mover and a seconder, please?
Sure.
Move, Councillor Gladewright, seconded Councillor Westwood. To think about your name then. Councillor Gladewright.
Thank you. A review of the Kingborough Awards Policy has been undertaken in accordance with scheduled timeframes, and the review of the policy has not identified any required changes, and it is recommended that it be adopted in its current form for a further 2 years.
Thank you. Councillor Minchley.
Thank you, Mayor. I absolutely support this policy review, and the awards are fantastic. I just had a thought that perhaps adding the word Kingborough Community Awards to the name could be, I felt like it was just a little bit more softer wording, and not to go on too much about that, but I would like to propose an amendment to change the name to Kingborough Community Awards.
I think that's a great idea. Would it be acceptable to the mover and the seconder? Yep, I think it kind of just... Yep, you're right. Okay, so we'll... throughout the policy, it'll be now known as the Kingborough Community Awards Policy. And the event will be the Kingborough Community Awards. Okay. That was easy. You look surprised. Okay. Councillor Bastone.
Thank you very much. My query just is that it's awarded to one person. Is there no ability for joint awards in any of our awards?
So we have done that in the past.
That's right, but this quite clearly doesn't state. It says an and one. So I'm just wondering if that should be changed.
Salisbury.
Through you, Mayor. It's not intended to preclude the giving of the award to two people, and obviously you've had that experience here before. I think it always is desirable if it can be won. I think sort of makes that person more special, I guess. If you think that we could perhaps make some acknowledgement that in some circumstances there may be joint recipients. Mm. I'm happy. I could add a sentence like
Thank
that
you.
To the policy.
I think it was 3 years ago we had joint recipients, yeah. And couples as well, yeah. Yep. Any further comments? If not, I will put the motion. It's got the slightly amended... title to it, and we will also see a sentence added to it that indicates that it could be joint winners of the Citizen of the Year. So it was moved by Councillor Gladewright and seconded by Councillor Westwood. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. The next item on page 110, revised WasteWise events policy, has been withdrawn. And just for information, that is because there was some feedback since the agenda came out about ways we could further improve that. So Ms Salisbury has asked that we withdraw it and come back at a later date. That will now be after we come out of caretaker mode in November, because we can't do a policy update during a caretaker period. If you go back and have a look at our caretaker policy that we have led the state with. You look confused by that.
Ask a question.
Sure.
So just in regards to that, I did ask a few things because I didn't note that it was really in line with our FOGO moving forward in regards to that. But in regards to FOGO bins being available at...
Okay, events. Sorry, I thought you were asking like a procedural question. Oh, if you've got any more questions on the policy, can you direct them to Mr Salisbury or the relevant person?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Okay, we turn to now to page 120, Payment of Councillor Expenses and Provision of Facilities, Policy 2.1, with a recommendation on page 121. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder. Councillor Street, seconder Councillor Fox. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. This is not a particularly groundbreaking policy. It's a policy that's all about our expenses and reimbursements. Thankfully, there hasn't been much change to this, and I say thankfully, because I do think that the councillor expenses policy is something that should be changed sparingly, especially when we've had a policy for a long time that has met council's needs and met with relative public support. I think the only change of significance is actually a reduction in an expense allowable, being a reduction in the per kilometre rate for vehicle allowance for those of us who claim it, and openly say I am not one of them, but we're reducing it to the council officer's rate of 50.44 cents per kilometre rather than the ATO rate. Seems to me that's a sensible thing to do. I'm not sure why councillors would be allowed to claim a higher rate than council officers, so that seems eminently sensible to me, and I commend the updated policy to council.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Councillor Midgley, and then Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm just wondering in regards to the notes around vehicle expenses, does that include electric vehicles?
Mr. Breen.
Sorry, just to extrapolate on that a bit more, and I've read some other councillor policies from other council areas, and they do actually make a statement that it does include electric vehicles.
I assure you, Mayor. Look, essentially, the allowance would relate to either petrol or electric vehicles, and certainly it's covered under the Tasmanian State Service allowance, which does not at this stage delineate between petrol cars and electric vehicles. I guess my understanding is that electric vehicles over the lifetime of ownership is pretty similar to the cost of owning a petrol vehicle. That's likely to change at some point in the future when they become a little bit cheaper. But I would say now the current allowance is probably appropriate for both types of vehicles.
Councillor Cordova and then Councillor Bastone.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a question on this one, and the preface of the question is that I think that this is good, that it's significantly limited. So, for example, for travel, it's the cap remains the same of $4,500 per year, per financial year as the maximum. Similarly, for maximum mobile service and data usage, charges paid by council will be $100 per month. So too with the maximum total value of electronic communication services and usage charges to be claimed can be $180 per month per councillor. And I've noticed in the annual report that the current councillor is restrained in their use of that. I think, you know, not too many councillors avail themselves of these provisions anyway. But my question relates to tracking and reporting. Is there provision within this policy, and if there is, maybe I missed it, about how we track. I think it would be interesting to see council by council about whether, you know, the more councillors are claiming more expenses or fewer expenses as the years go by. So is there some kind of tracking and reporting for the sake of transparency that would appear in the annual report over the years?
Well, our councillors' expenses versus, say, Huon Valley or Hobart?
That would be an interesting one, but also I was thinking over time, would be interesting to see if, in the early 2000s, people were using more money than in the late 2000s. I'm not suggesting we go back 100 years. I'm saying starting from now, wouldn't it be good to be able to track that?
It probably would, but would be a bit cumbersome for Mr. Breen and his staff. We do feel free to go back through the old annual reports. Is that information readily available?
Yes, through you, Mayor. Certainly the information is available and is reported, as you say, every year in the to the council and in the annual report. So it would just be a matter of extracting the data. So it certainly is possible. It would be up to council as to whether they want us to bring this data back to the council or publish it in any report.
Somehow I have a feeling it will only result in an outcry from residents saying, oh, they shouldn't even get paid, let alone expenses. Councillor Bastone and then Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm assuming your role now of reading everything very, very carefully to look at grammatical and spelling errors. And this is not quite that, but in the mayoral vehicle on page 124, this vehicle may also be used by the mayor for other incidental private mileage where it is convenient for her to do so.
I did notice that. I think at some stage
we might have a male mayor again. Probably not, but it might happen. So.
I'm not actually sure when that slipped in, because this hasn't been reviewed since... when was it last reviewed? So we made Dina female for a while there. Okay. I might just want to fix that to be more gender neutral or something.
They.
Them. Yep. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. And I note I asked a question before, so am I able just to say a few comments now?
Yes.
Thank you. It's not a question. I guess just in regards to Councillor Cordova's comments in regards to tracking councillors' expenses and things, and yes, Mayor, the sentiment around, yes, we shouldn't be paid. I think there's many of us around the table here that do work hard and count this as a part-time job. And many of us don't claim, and some of us do, and there should be no judgment around that. And I think it then means that we have to open it up to people who perhaps, need to claim many of these expenses just for their daily living. The price of living is going up higher and higher if you're in a pension and things like that. So I think it's really important that we do have these available claims there and put on the record that I do encourage that people who are considering standing, noting that we do get a remuneration, but also that we can claim for other expenses as well. And I think that it is important that we can, and important also that we have a choice as to whether we wish to or not.
Thank you. Any further comments? Otherwise, I'm going to put the recommendation. The motion was moved by Councillor Street, seconded by Councillor Fox, as printed on page 121. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Always gets to the time of the evening when I can't say that word. Happens every meeting, and it's only 7:35. Event support grants pilot, page 134, with a recommendation on page 137, looking for a mover. Got one in Councillor Midgley and a seconder in Councillor Cordova. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. Well, Councillor Wass, you had your hand up. That's very exciting to see. I support this event support grants pilot because it is innovative. The Love Living Locally Festival is something that has been very well supported, that the community has loved. COVID put a bit of a dampener on that in regards to change, so changing it up we are. And that was a motion that was put forward to Council. So thank you to the staff who have put a lot of work and thought in regards to the development of this pilot. No doubt they've looked to other councils who do event grants as well. Many of our surrounding councils do, and some offer a substantial amount in regards to event support. And the Mayor and I have had many meetings with different community members, of multicultural community members who would love to put on an event
in Kingborough, but one of the prohibiting factors are in regards to the low amount that is available in our community grants and the limitations available in that. So it is really exciting that we will have $5,000, which, you know, is a nominal amount really for an event, because bands and things do charge a lot of money, but it is a start and it is a conversation. And I like that it's at least for two new major Kingborough events, and it's not just in the Kingston area. Guess what? Channel and Bruni, like, we're moving out. We are spreading the love across Kingborough, so it's exciting at the possibilities of where these could be, the Snug Oval or something, who knows where. And also there's another one sitting alongside that to support some smaller grants available to support some established events that, again, had that break during COVID to, I guess, reinvigorate that. So I look forward to any discussion or debate, but I think it's something that, as a council, we can be proud to look at this innovation, something that could be different. And if it really doesn't, work, then we can go back to the love living locally that people did really enjoy.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Further comments? Councillor Bastone.
Sorry. I just have a couple of questions. On page 135, for the smaller grants, the event must be an established event that has been delivered on at least two occasions prior to the outbreak of coronavirus pandemic in 2020. Do we know how many of these there were?
Mrs. Salisbury. Through you, Mayor, no, I don't know how many there were, but I'm advised by the community services team that there were community events that sort of, are stopped and have had trouble getting going again. And these grants, that $6,000 is really just a section of the $30,000 for the ordinary community grants, just to help events that might have stopped get wound up again. Now, when we call for applications, there are not enough of those coming forward, then that money would simply go back into the community grants fund.
Right, thank you. That was part of my worry. The other thing in this, in the same group, they must be financially viable and able to demonstrate the capacity to successfully manage and administer their proposed event on time and have appropriate public liability cover. That's fine, but then you say later on they can use the money for the public liability cover. Well, they can't. They have to show you that they have it before they can raise the event, so how can they use it for the public liability cover?
Mrs. Salisbury.
Through you, Mayor, I think if they were able to demonstrate that they could run a perfect event and it would be a really good outcome for Kingborough, and the only piece of the puzzle was the public liability insurance cover, and they wanted to use the grant for that, then I think that would be an acceptable use.
Any further comments? I just had a brief one. I just wanted to echo the sentiments of Councillor Midgley, because her and I have had a number of meetings with residents who have wanted to start events, who are very enthusiastic about them, but one of the big barriers is the financial commitment involved. But also, what's really great to see is that under this policy now, we can have the grant money go towards performers or activities, and that is a real barrier for some of the other grants that are available, particularly for artistic performances, that they exclude specifically paying artists, which makes no sense to me at all, and it doesn't make sense to a lot of those performers either. So hopefully this will be very effective in trying to stimulate some of those bigger events, but also reactivating the smaller ones. I did just have one question at 4.6. I take it that there would be a deed of agreement for the grant, that if the event doesn't go ahead, that the money is returned to council in full.
Through you, Mayor, yes, there would be. There would be a letter of agreement between the council and the grant recipient.
Thank you. And we also, as part of that, require full acquittal of the grant in terms of expenditure and outcomes?
Yes, yep. Ma'am.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't have anything further. If nobody else does, would you like to sum up? No? All right, I'm going to put the motion as moved by Councillor Midgley, seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried unanimously. We turn now to page 138 and the annual plan for 2022-23 with a recommendation on page 139. Got a mover in Councillor Street, seconder in Councillor Fox. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. It's with pleasure that I move the recommended motion being the acceptance of the draft annual plan for 22-23. It is a good plan. It's very pleasing that on page, or actually I've lost the page number, but it's page 3 or 4, we get our one-page strategic plan, which I think is one of the great achievements of this council, bizarrely, summed up in under 15 words. And that's that our vision is that our community is at the heart of everything we do. Our purpose is to make Kingborough a great place to live, and our values are accountability, respect, excellence and inclusiveness. And I think that the annual plan for 2022-2023 is an example of us following that strategic vision for the community and for our municipality. I think that it shows our support for the community. It shows our striving to protect the way of life that's important to ratepayers and residents of Kingborough. It shows that we're committed to the environment of our municipality, and it shows that we're committed to our ratepayers, and that we're committed to a strong financial management and ensuring that this municipality is financially stable for many, many years to come and can continue to deliver the excellent outcomes that I think have been a hallmark of this term of council, especially. But a lot of hard work prior also. So I do commend the annual plan to council. I think there are some excellent projects planned for the next 12 months, and I could go through them each individually, but what I would do is encourage ratepayers and anybody listening to read the annual plan. It's not as extensive a document as it has been previously, and I think that that is a good thing. It is a highlight of what we are doing. And what is important to us as council and what we hope is important to the community as well. And I commend it both to my colleagues and to the community generally.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. And I agree with Councillor Street. Congratulations to the team for putting this together. It's exciting and it's good, particularly on pages 8 and 9 of the plan, which are pages 151 and 152 of our agenda, in which we identify bushfire preparedness, robust emergency management and upgrading the existing two-way radio system with a digital mobile radio system to improve operational communications and safety in emergency management situations. This is something I'm particularly passionate about. So too is it good to see our commitment to implement our net zero emissions by 2035 target, to review the climate change plan, develop a coastal hazard adaptation policy, undertake the SNUG climate change adaptation project, and to encourage greater uptake of FOGO. All important endeavours. My first question through you, Mayor, is about on page 10 of the plan, so I'm looking at page 153 of our agenda. The plan reads, quote, progressively increase smoke-free public and community spaces in Kingborough and specifically undertake consultation with relevant stakeholders for the declaration of the Kingborough Sports Precinct as a smoke-free area. Councillors will recall that at the council meeting on 20th of December 2021, I moved a motion seconded by Councillor Fox that was successfully adopted that council will advertise its intention to declare the Kingborough Sports Precinct a smoke-free area and seek user group and community feedback before a final decision after the feedback period. My question is, what is the timing for the declaration of the sports precinct as smoke-free, and what are the hold-ups in getting that consultation running?
Mr. Snee.
Through you, Mayor, I do know that the consultation has been prepared because our senior environmental health officer did get a list of all those stakeholders from me only a couple of weeks ago. But having said that, she's now changed jobs, so that's probably the hold-up in this process, and we would be awaiting her replacement before we can move further.
Sure, thank you. That's eminently understandable. My next question through you, Mayor, is about page... But I should say that I really look forward to that taking place, and I think there are many stakeholders who do as well. On page 12, so this is page 155 of our agenda, the plan says Council will, quote, upgrade security systems. My question is, to what location specifically does this refer, and specifically what security systems will be upgraded, and upgraded to what?
It's just me.
Through you, Mayor, that statement would relate to increased numbers of CCTV cameras in Kingston Park. It also relates to security patrols that we have budgeted for in the current financial year, and they will be deployed on an as-needs basis depending on the feedback we get in relation to antisocial behaviour, etc.
Thank you. My next question is about, on page 158, the final dot point on page 158, and that's page 15 of the plan, it talks about the incoming Tasmanian planning scheme, and it says, quote, including the provision of additional specific area plans, end quote. May we please, I figure this is a good opportunity to just quickly run down which areas will be receiving a specific area plan and speak to any of the highlights in that.
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Councillor Cordova, I know that our strategic planner has been very keen to commence some precinct planning with Council. And, for example, many of the councillors would be aware that the Hobart City Council have undertaken a regime of precinct planning recently. That's the sort of process that the strategic planner wants to put in place. Resulting out of that would be a specific area plan to capture that detail in the planning scheme moving forward.
Thank you, Mayor. To conclude my remarks, I think it's always good to have these plans on a page to be able to see where we're heading and what we're working on, what we consider to be the priorities. Kingborough Council is, I think, doing a good job, and there's always more to be done, but as long as we keep the community at the heart of everything we do, I think our intentions will be going in the right direction. So I look forward to implementing this vision, and I commend the motion. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Bastone.
Thank you. This is an excellent report, and I really enjoyed reading it, and I particularly enjoyed on page 155 reading the community facilities and our actions and initiatives. But I just wondered what happens to the ones that don't get done. We have some from last year and probably the year before that have, for various reasons, have not been implemented. And I'm just wondering if there is not some way in a report to say why they haven't been done, rather than the community just thinking that we put these things out, but, you know, really we just do what we want to do.
I assume that would be when we have the progress reports against this, but General Manager, did you want to add anything, or just me?
Thank you, Mayor. I mean, I guess this is the annual report looking forward, so the annual plan that's looking forward. The explanation in relation to why projects haven't been done would come in the annual report rather than the annual plan. But as the Mayor said, there is also that opportunity for the reports that we do provide throughout the year. But in general, the annual plan looks forward, and to a degree, it's with our best endeavours that we're going to implement these things. But as always, there are things that come along.
Thank you. Are there any further comments? I just wanted to briefly just acknowledge the work of Mrs. Morton and Ms. Adams, who have worked very hard on this, as well as other staff members to get this together. It's doing this and the annual report is no small task. I think it looks terrific, but I think importantly it actually does give a message to our community that we aren't just about roads, rates and rubbish, and that we do a lot more here. And I know I was at odds with our former mayor when he used to say, and our deputy mayor, talking about getting back to basics. But I think that this plan shows the breadth of the things that we do for our community very much. So I do hope that members of the community take the opportunity to read it. So it was moved by Councillor Street. Did you want to sum up? No? OK, I'm going to put the motion. Moved by Councillor Street, seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried. We turn now to page 166, the financial report for July 2022, with a recommendation on page 167. I saw a hand go up enthusiastically on my right. It's moved by Councillor Westwood and seconded Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I don't think there's too much to say at this juncture. This is the financial report for July, the first month of the financial year. And it largely reflects the budget that was recently approved by councillors.
Further contributions or questions? I have a question, Mr. Breen. I'm assuming it's just a typo. On page 166, under the discussion 4.1, the last dot point, I kept reading the sentence to try and make it make sense, and then I went to the table, so I think I've worked it out. But it says other income is 28K over budget, primarily due to private works revenue of 12K under budget and finance of 7K under budget. So should that be other income is 28K under budget?
Yes, through you, Mayor, yes, it should be.
Because my math is really bad, so it could have been either. Okay, thank you. Further questions? Councillor Gladewright.
Thank you. Just trying to make sense of what my question was. It was to do in 4.1, the second dot point, statutory fees and fines are 47 under budget due to revenue from planning being 33,000 under budget as a result of reduced volumes of applications. Does that mean that we make some kind of estimate on how many applications there are going to be and then it's gone under that, or why? How does that
Mr. Breen. Yeah, through you, Mayor. Yeah, look, essentially, we tend to base it on what's happened the previous year. So we'll have a look at the previous year and say, look, there's so many applications at the applicable application cost, and then that's the way the budget is formulated. So when there's a shift in volume one way or the other, then we'll either be over or under budget. So clearly July was a bit of a slow month and we were under budget. So far, I know we're only halfway through the month of August, but August is looking like a month that will either be on budget or perhaps a little bit over budget. So it can fluctuate up and down a little bit depending on the amount of activity that's going on at a point in time.
It just seems unusual to me that we're making an assumption about how many applications there would be. It would be more conservative to underestimate that, I suppose.
Yeah, through the Mayor. Yeah, look, I guess it's hard to come up with a budget that's less than the previous year's result without actually having something to support that, and then planning can be a little bit hit and miss in regards to when the activity will occur and what sort of stimulants are going on in the economy that'll get businesses, I guess, planners and builders getting the work done. So it can be a little bit of guesswork, but certainly we've got some data that does support the estimates that we put together.
Thank you.
I just realised I had one other question, if I can ask that before I throw to Councillor Westwood. Page 173, other income, loss of Bruni contract, $200,000. Could you just remind me, is that roadworks to do with the state government, or what was... Is that...
Yeah,
there was no other explanation elsewhere.
Through you, Mayor. Yes, councillors lost the contract down at Bruni Island for the state government. And so what we've done is just had a look and said, look, there's $700,000 worth of lost income. Our expectation is that we can save about $500,000 in contractor and our own staffing costs, but the net result will be around about a $200,000 deficit. Based on losing that particular contract.
So do we have any understanding of why we lost those contracts? Did it go out to tender and we were beaten by somebody else, or what? what was the arrangement?
Yeah, look, Mr Johnson may want to help me here, but my understanding is that the state government's looking for one contractor in the south and I think one in the north as well, and so the current contractor that does the bulk of the state government work down south is taking over the Bruny Island contract.
Okay. Thank you. Councillor Westwood, did you have a question? No? Councillor Bastone.
I was just going to say we didn't lose the complete contract off Bruny Island, only the two main roads, I believe. The other roads the council is still doing the contract on. Stornoway has the contract for the two main roads.
Mr Johnson.
Through you, Mayor. The only contract that council had for was Bruny Island State Roads, so main roads owned and managed by DSG, which we're no longer doing. The only part of the contract that council may be doing into the future is some litter collection on behalf of Stornoway, who are acting now as a contractor to DSG. And that would be at Rowett's Point. I think there's daily litter collection there. And there may be some other tasks that they've no doubt forgotten about along the way that they may be coming back and asking council to try and facilitate. But in terms of road maintenance, no, we won't be doing any contracting on Bruny Island for road maintenance.
Thank you. Further comments, questions? If not, Councillor Westwood, do you want to sum up? Thank you. I'll put the motion as printed on page 167, moved by Councillor Westwood, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried. Turn now to page 189, Notices of Motion. Councillor Cordova submitted a notice of motion headed Regulating the Use of Facial Recognition Technology and Biometric Data Capture in Kingborough, and there is also an officer's response from Mr Malt. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. This motion is about Kingborough Council.
Hey, I'm looking for a seconder first. So it's moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. This motion is about Kingborough Council taking leadership to allay community fears about the increasing encroachment on civil liberties. It's about stopping in its tracks the ability of a future council to collect, store and pass along personal data of Kingborough residents and their children that council, to be frank, has no business to collect. This motion is about our strategic goal, 2.3, of having community facilities that are safe, accessible and meet contemporary standards. Facial recognition technology and biometric data capture is a digital fingerprint. It is equivalent to collecting and storing a fingerprint or a swab of saliva for DNA. Ask yourself, when you go into a hardware store or a clothing store with your child, or indeed when you stop by council to use the recycling kiosk in the reception, would it be appropriate for one of the employees to insist on collecting a copy of your child's fingerprint or taking a DNA swab? Ask yourself, would it be appropriate for your child playing at Kingston Park to have a council officer collect their fingerprint or take a DNA swab off the play equipment? The only data that council should be collecting on people in the public domain is data that is necessary, proportionate and reasonable. To say you don't care about privacy because you have nothing to hide is the same as saying you don't care about free speech because you have nothing to say. As we were told by Council's Chief Information Officer in response to my question on notice on the 1st of August, quote, most commercially available CCTV recording systems have facial recognition capability that can be configured and activated, end quote. And we know that Council owns and manages some CCTV, and we also know that Tasmania Police operates some of and monitors some of the Council's CCTV. Is it necessary, proportionate and reasonable for our playgrounds, our civic centre, our sports facilities, our bathrooms and our parks to have technology that can collect face prints? No, it clearly is not. It is unreasonable. Even if we had a policy on it, which we don't, it would be unreasonable. Adelaide City Council found it unreasonable. San Francisco didn't think it was reasonable. The European Parliament didn't think it was reasonable. Now, we all leave digital crumbs, digital exhaust, a digital trace every day in basically everything we do, and I acknowledge that we may not be able to stop Tasmania Police from using our camera footage for facial recognition purposes. I acknowledge, indeed, that if you use basically any product from one of the tech giants, that you're probably already caught up in a web of digital surveillance. I realise that a single council motion won't solve a world riddled with these problems, but what I'm putting forward is a motion in the spirit of thinking globally and acting locally. We can control what council does. We can control what we do and how we use our CCTV.
As a council, we can draw a line in the sand and set a good example for others. We can let our community know that even if other government agencies, even if other private sector authorities find it advantageous to trample all over our digital rights, as a council, we are knitted from a stronger moral fibre. We know that we have no business as a council collecting and storing your children's face prints and then passing those along to third parties. In June this year, controversy over Adelaide's plans to upgrade its CCTV with face recognition capability led the council to vote unanimously not to purchase the necessary software. The council then asked South Australia Police not to use facial recognition technology until legislation is in place to govern its use. Adelaide City Council voted unanimously not to include the technology in its new security cameras being installed across the CBD. According to Innovation Oz, quote, the long-running review of Australia's privacy law will present a final report to government by the end of 2022 as the new Attorney General seeks to curtail the, quote, highly invasive use of personal information. For council, our council here in Kingborough, to be best prepared for this new legislation framework, we would do well to clean up our Digital Act ready for those tighter legal frameworks, making sure we have clear policies and procedures in place to ensure that Kingborough Council is only collecting information that is necessary, proportionate and reasonable. Now, we've all heard those stories from overseas where jurisdictions have adopted facial recognition technology and biometric data capture, and they're using it irresponsibly. We've heard those dystopian stories about social credit scores where jaywalking too many times or rocking up to work too many times late in the morning, and it results in your bank account being frozen or you being blocked from using public transport or prohibited from attending sporting events. We know that in the USA, if you participated in the BLM movement or protested the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision, you likely had your biometric data captured and stored. No matter what side of politics you're on, your council has no business collecting and storing a copy of your face print, and you should be concerned. Not only does this technology have flaws that gives false positives, not only is it used to over-police neighbourhoods, not only is it used to on-sell to advertisers, but it is a fundamental infringement on your right to be a peaceful law-abiding citizen and not have unnecessary search and seizure of your personal information. That's why we must oppose it, that's why we must ban it,
time.
And that's why we're on the record tonight.
Thank
to
you.
Know where
time
we stand
has expired. Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Westwood.
Thank you. A few questions. Do we collect biometric data at Kingborough Council?
We don't have Mr. Malt, so I'm assuming the General Manager.
Through you, Mayor, the answer is no.
Have we considered collecting biometric data, including fingerprints, DNA swabs or face prints, at any time in the near future? And are we likely to do that?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor, no, it has not been on the radar, Councillor Westwood.
Thank you. If we did have an appetite to do that, could we afford to do that, given we've just considered our financial report for July 2022?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor, I'm not certain I'm in a position to answer that question, primarily because I'm not aware of the costings, but I suspect it may not be cheap.
Thank you. So, in summary, I feel that this notice of motion is completely unnecessary, irrelevant and a complete waste of this council's time, given we are absolutely unlikely to collect biometric data. And Councillor Cordova, I think you're scaremongering people in our community by talking about collecting children's fingerprints from play equipment, and I don't think it's appropriate they've brought this notice of motion before our council tonight.
Thank you, Councillor Westwood. I've got Councillor Fox next.
I'm just wondering, we've got CCTV cameras in our playgrounds, and that information is collected by police, but it's organised by council. I know we've got a safety committee who has asked for increasingly to have more and more cameras in public places, and the police take all this information, and we don't know as a council how they use it. For us to think that they don't use it for facial recognition, I think we'd be kidding ourselves, because if there was somebody causing, for example, vandalising our playground equipment, the police would certainly know who that was. So I think indirectly we are providing this sort of information, and we are actually condoning and encouraging more cameras in public places that we actually own. and I don't know if I want any. Well, if do I need a member of staff to confirm or deny that this is happening? I think we're all aware of it.
I'll ask the general manager to comment, perhaps.
Thank you.
Through you, Mayor, Councillor Fox. I'm not the subject matter expert. Suffice to say. But what I can say is that in the response, the officer's response on the agenda to the notice of motion tonight, there are a number of existing federal and state legislation acts in place currently that even the police need to abide by. And that would all come out in any report should this notice of motion be supported.
Any further comments or questions? Otherwise, I'm going to ask Councillor Cordova if you'd like to sum up.
Thank you, Mayor. This is about leadership. It's about controlling what we can control. The analogue that I drew is not about scaremongering. It's about the reality that when you take somebody's digital fingerprint, their face print, that is analogous. It is the same as... But the point, it is the same thing. It is the same thing. So if you're uncomfortable with that notion, then you should also be uncomfortable with the notion of council having CCTV in public places capturing this information which can easily be upgraded and passed along to third parties. This is the reality of the world that we live in which the regulation has not caught up to speed with the use of technology, and we've heard the consumer report from Choice in June this year that said many high street retailers, including ones in Kingborough, are using this technology. Now, this for council is about drawing a line in the sand. Now is a good time for council to act, not just in light of the Choice report, to send a clear message to the community that we care and that we are alert to these issues, but also because the changes being ushered into the Privacy Act will mean that there will be a tighter regulatory framework, and so council has no business collecting this information, and we shouldn't collect this information, and it will cost us more in the long run to have to rectify that. We might as well do it now. Two dozen cities in the United States, the City of Adelaide, the European Parliament, they all think it's wrong, and they've taken steps to elevate the need for regulation to catch up. They've taken the lead, and we should do the same thing as well. Saying you don't care about this issue because you have nothing to hide is like saying that you don't care about free speech because you have nothing to say. Saying that just because council doesn't use it now doesn't mean that a future council won't, and saying that there's no chance that council will use it, I believe, is actually quite naive to the reality of the speed at which this technology is changing and the uptake among private sector organisations and government authorities to utilise this information and for them to request it from councils. So that's why the City of Adelaide took the steps that they did, and that's why we should do the same. Tonight, each of us at this table can either put our heads in the sand and pretend like this isn't an issue that the community cares about, pretend like this isn't an issue that's on the horizon for all of us. We can pretend like there's no problem, nothing to see here, but we know from jurisdictions overseas that this is a big problem. And it is something that council... You can't claim that this isn't a council issue and it's irrelevant. These are our cameras on our property that are managed by us. How could you claim that this isn't a council issue? It's our cameras. So I've made the point very clear that the regulation has not caught up to the use of the technology. The technology is currently being used irresponsibly by some parties, and I think that we should stand up as a leader in Tasmania.
Councillor Cordova, your 3-minute sum up has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to put the motion. It was moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against?
No.
A show of hands is required. All those in favour? In favour is Councillors Cordova, Midgley, Fox, Bastone. Yep. Against is Councillors Wass, Gladewright, Street, Westwood and Reet. The motion is lost. We turn now to page 191, a motion submitted by Councillor Cordova in relation to a report into entire home short stay accommodation, and there is a officer's response from Ms Tyler Moore. So I've got a mover in Councillor Cordova, and I'm looking for a seconder, please. Seconded by Councillor Midgley. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. We're in a housing crisis. Soon there will be a new council, and those councillors should have all the information they need at their fingertips to make a good decision and to hit the ground running when they come on board to address in a meaningful way, take action and steps to mitigate the housing crisis that Kingborough faces. This motion recognises that now, at the end of our term, we shouldn't take drastic action ourselves. We're coming up to a caretaker period. But instead, this motion seeks to prepare all the evidence and information required to give a new set of councillors a report that they can pick up in the new term and give them an informed conversation around whole home rentals and short-stay visitor accommodation in Kingborough. The motion asks just for a report, it is not a ban. Recent actions taken to regulate whole dwelling short-stay visitor accommodation by Brisbane City Council, Noosa Council, Byron Shire and Hobart City Council mean that there are lessons now to be learned from those experiences. That's what makes this an opportune time to get this report prepared. There are many options, planning scheme amendments, these are being looked at by Hobart City Council, differential rating systems, permit caps and applying commercial rates. There are geospatial considerations, maybe the report will come back and say we should only think about this for residential areas or maybe it will say something else. As of the beginning of August 2022, the website Inside Airbnb claims that Kingborough has 327 entire homes or apartments listed on Airbnb. New research has shown that 327 whole homes taken off the rental market has driven down rental vacancy rates in Greater Hobart, and econometric data indicates clearly this is causing a very significant upward pressure on the cost of renting and the ability of people in Kingborough to find rentals. Rent levels are the result of the balance between supply and demand in a housing market. A summary measure of this balance is the rental vacancy rate, which is what I refer to in this report. That rate is calculated by taking the total number of dwellings available to rent and dividing that by the total number of rental dwellings multiplied by 100 to get a percentage. Economist Sol Eslake has said that if the vacancy rate is above 2.5%, then rates of rent tend to be stable. But if that vacancy rate drops to less than 1%, that generates double-digit rent increases. And that's what we're seeing in Greater Hobart, Kingborough included. Local councils across Australia are grappling with the impact of whole dwelling, entire home short-stay accommodation, exacerbating the housing crisis. This motion is asking for a report. Hobart City Council is already well advanced down this path, and we should do potentially the same, but The idea is to get all of the different options, whether that's planning scheme amendments, permit caps, or alternatives, put them on the table for the new council to consider. The evidence is now in that a small change in the number of whole home dwellings taken off the long-term rental market and put into short stay is having a direct impact on the rental market. And in Greater Hobart, they found that the withdrawal of just 195 properties from the private rental market can move the vacancy rate from 2%, where rent rises are manageable, to 1%, where rent rises are likely to be over 10%. And I just mentioned that we have 327 of these in Kingborough right now, and there are more to come. In Hobart City Council alone, it was 481 dwellings that were given planning approval for a change of short-stay accommodation from 2014 to 2021, December the 31st. This report will not be a single fix. Regulating whole dwelling short-stay visitor accommodations is not a single fix. It is, however, low-hanging fruit to fix the housing crisis in the short term. And in order to fix the housing crisis in the long term, of course, we need to work with partners in state government, and we need to talk about increasing supply, increasing density, rezoning for mixed use, encouraging landholders to turn unused shops, offices and car parks into residences, and taxing empty homes. However, right now, we need to get the ball rolling on regulating whole home short-stay accommodation, and that is what this motion seeks to do. So I urge you to support. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Bastone.
Thank you, Mayor. Can I just say Kingborough is quite different to the Greater Hobart. Most of our whole house rentals will be on places like Bruny Island, down at Gordon. These are not options, viable options for people who want to commute into Hobart for work. I think if we're going to look at anything at all, we would have to do it by zoning, and there would have to be something that, you know, it doesn't include places south of XYZ, or it doesn't include Bruny Island or whatever you want to do. But we are definitely not Hobart, and most of our long-term homes are not here within the main part of Kingborough.
Thank you, Councillor Bastone. Next, I've got Councillor Street, and then Councillor Gladright.
Thank you, Mayor. Perhaps I think Councillor Bastone makes an excellent point in terms of the demographics and location relative of Kimber to other areas of Greater Hobart. And unlike the mover, I don't believe that the answer to the housing shortage in southern Tasmania and Tasmania more generally is as simple as disincentivising whole house short stay accommodation. I don't believe that either having whole house short stay accommodation or not having it is a zero-sum game either. I think that there are a number of benefits to the community in having sufficient visitor accommodation available. Tourism, after all, being a massive industry in Tasmania and a big industry in Kimber indeed, employs a lot of our ratepayers and a lot of Tasmanians. I accept that there are benefits to freeing up whole homes for the rental market. There's no doubt about that. But my issue with the motion is that it seems to me that it presupposes an objective, a solution to a problem that seems to me to be far more complicated than simply disincentivising whole home short stay accommodation or not doing it. In fact, it presupposes that restricting, prohibiting or disincentivising the use of entire homes for short stay accommodation in all of Kimber must be a good thing. And I don't think that this matter is as simple as that. Policy doesn't follow physics by any stretch of the imagination, but for every action, there is going to be, perhaps not an equal reaction, but there is going to be some push and pull in other areas. And I think it's important to consider that, and I don't think that the motion as drafted will do that. The issue of housing affordability is much more complicated than this motion posits. And I think that there are other things that are equally, if not far more important. And while we're talking about the impact that putting more homes out of the short stay accommodation market into the rental market is, I think it's also important to think about the impact that the five homes that this council approved the development of tonight will be. And I note that the mover was the only person on this council who didn't accept the professional advice to accept that development application and have those homes built. So I think looking at that, both within our municipality and in other municipalities in Hobart, is really important. I think looking at Hobart City Council rejecting accommodation developments in areas where they ought to be is really important as well. Directly going to impact that push and pull for short stay accommodation in Greater Hobart if there are more hotels. What are Hobart City doing to incentivise that rather than reject those developments? What are we doing to incentivise housing development both in Kingborough and outside? Well, again, we had an example this evening of an attempt to further disincentivise development in Kingborough through developer penalties for biodiversity offsets rather than a legitimate purpose of protecting biodiversity values. These are all important things, and I don't think that the solution to any of these problems is as simple as the motion puts it, and I won't be supporting it.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Next, I have Councillor Gladright and then Councillor Fox.
Thank you. I will be supporting this motion. I do thank the mover for bringing this to Council. I think it's a really... It is a really important thing that we should be looking at, and the motion is really just seeking a report. It's not proposing a motion, although the words do say that. I probably would feel more comfortable if it was a little bit broader, but I hope that whoever did prepare that report was able to take into consideration some of the things that have been raised by Councillor Bastone about the fact that we do have areas which are not so suited to long-term rentals anyway. So I don't think it hurts at this point in requesting a report. It's not getting us to commit to anything in particular, but having information is important. So I'd be interested to read what the report comes back with.
Thank you, Councillor Glade-Wright. Next I had Councillor Fox and then Councillor Westwood.
I'd hate for this motion to be lost, and I would support it, but I'm wondering whether, without the information before us of how much short-stay accommodation of entire homes we have in Kingborough, whether I should put an amendment that would read that a report will be prepared for the council to consider the effects of the use of entire homes for short stay accommodation in Kingborough, rather than preempting that we want to restrict, prohibit or disincentivise, because we don't know how many homes there are, how many entire homes there are. We don't know where they are. We don't know in proportion to how many there are, the lack of rental homes. There may well be a correlation between the two. I just feel as though we've got a lot of information about Hobart, Great Hobart, etc., but not very much about Kingborough. And I do think we need a report, but I think, as another speaker said, maybe not putting a negative spin on it in that we want to restrict it or prohibit or disincentivise, because, in fact, we may not need to. So I would like to put that amendment if I could have a seconder.
General Manager, on a procedural motion.
Through you, Mayor. Councillor Fox, whilst I implicitly understand where you're coming from, my concern is, without looking at the meeting procedure regulations, that your amendment is contradictory to the notice of motion before you.
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. The notice of motion, as it's worded, seeks a report to restrict, prohibit or disincentivise. I go back to my original comments.
Okay. Councillor Westwood.
Just a point of procedure question around that. Can Councillor Fox foreshadow if that one is lost, she can propose a new motion or...
General Manager. No, not tonight. Councillor Westwood.
Thank you, Mayor. I echo a lot of the sentiments expressed by Councillor Street tonight, but also to note that the work involved in providing this advice and considering this as a policy for our council, I imagine would be a lot. And I imagine it would also be our planning staff who would be taken away from the processing of development applications in order to do that. I think, for me, on balance, the priority at the moment is our staff getting through the number of development applications that they currently have before them, so that we can get homes that are in the pipeline approved and built as quickly as possible. And I would prefer, in terms of a resourcing priority, that planning staff were focused on approving DAs as opposed to working on policy such as what is proposed before us.
Thank you, Councillor Westwood. Any further contributions? If not, yes. Look, I appreciate the...
Mayor, sorry, I just put my light on. Sorry about that.
Oh, sorry. Councillor Midgley.
Sorry, I think it was when you looked down. Yes, thank you, everybody, for your contribution, and Councillor Cordova for putting this forward. I think we have another motion put forward by you, Mayor, following this, and I think it is important, I do believe that it is important that we need to look holistically at the housing situation and look at ways that we can make them more available, affordable, rentable and so forth. Absolutely hear the points from everybody who has spoken here, and really it looks to me like in the future, hopefully the future council will look at some sort of a housing strategy or affordable housing strategy for Kingborough, because it definitely, we haven't had that full picture on the table here at council, and we're going to do little bits and bobs here and there, but I guess hopefully the next council will look at something like that, as other councils have. In regards to the zoning, I think, again, I'd like, you know, that could be covered in a report that would come back to council. I think there's some good points there by Councillor Bastone, but also noting on Bruny Island, I've heard that people who work in cafes and cleaning and things like that can't actually get any accommodation there because a lot of the accommodation is actually Airbnb, so therefore they have to travel off-island all the time to go to work. Also, I think in regards to the time, and absolutely Councillor Westwood in regards to the time taken by staff and the fact that we want, you know, to help that workload that's happening currently at the moment to get approvals for dwellings to be built now, would I be correct in us stating this, that I wouldn't see this report coming back to this current council? Is that correct?
It can't.
Yes.
Because we're going to caretaker mode.
So I just wanted to
from the 5th of September.
I thought so. So I wouldn't then see this, you know, as an actual. And there's no actual date as to when it needs to come or anything like that. So hopefully this could be done within some other time that they might have. But I think it fulfills that full picture where local governments are looking as to what they can do to look at this housing crisis that we are in. Yes, perhaps the wording of the motion could have been prepared a bit differently, but I think it's important to put it on the table. It's important to support it, and for the next council to be able to have a report that they can scrutinise, have the full picture on, and to see then where to move forward on that.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Just before I ask Councillor Cordover if he would like to sum up, I just wanted to say a couple of words. I appreciate the intent of this motion, but I don't think, as Councillor Fox mentioned, I don't think that it's worded appropriately. I think it's presuming an outcome that we don't know that it could present. It's sort of directing almost the author of the report to give us exactly a certain outcome. I would have been interested in seeing a report that gives us a range of options, but probably more importantly, to my mind, there is still a legal question mark over the actions that the Hobart City Council have taken with their recommendations. And I would have liked to have seen that as a test case legally first to see whether we actually do have the power to do something like this, because otherwise we could find ourselves in very, very hot water and incurring significant legal fees for our community. So given that it's written in the way it is, I support the intent. I'd like to see some information, but I don't like the way this is worded. So I won't be supporting it, but I also would like to just see how the situation in Hobart unfolds and whether we can learn anything from that, because we are very much in uncharted territory. So, Councillor Cordover, did you want to sum up?
Thank you, Mayor. Some councillors don't like the wording of this motion. They say it's written in the wrong way. They say that they support the intent, but they don't like how it's worded. To paraphrase one of my esteemed councillor colleagues, let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Isn't that right, Councillor Street? Housing is a human right, and I make no apologies for trying to find solutions to ensure that Kingborough is able to help solve this housing crisis that we all acknowledge we're in. And a crisis means that it's urgent. So we've heard the argument today that doing a report would, you know, be a bit of a bureaucratic paperwork nightmare for the people who would have to put the report together, and it's much better that they just work on getting houses in the pipeline to build those houses, to get them through the planning process and have them built as quickly as possible. That's how we'll solve the housing crisis. Well, how long does it take to build a home? Is it a week? Is it a month? I think for those people who are facing the pointy end of the housing crisis right now, they would want a faster solution than just waiting for planning staff to approve more houses. I think we have the solution before us. It's evidence-based, and I think a lot of the speculation that we've heard in tonight's debate about why we think Kingborough might be different from Greater Hobart, even though Kingborough is part of Greater Hobart, and I've just pointed to the evidence for it, but a lot of this speculation would be brought out by the report. So what we're trying to do in the report is find out if indeed, maybe Councillors Bastone and Street are correct, that Kingborough is substantially different from Hobart. Well, let's find out in the report. If there are other things that are far more important than banning whole dwelling short stay accommodations or curbing them, well, let's find out. Let the experts, let the officers tell us in the report. I have a question. What percentage of development applications presented to this council are passed? That's a legitimate question. My belief is that it's like 95%. We are passing as many development applications as we can. We are contributing to the supply of housing, and that takes years. What we also need to do is think about the other low-hanging fruit that exists, and I pointed to the evidence that whole-dwelling short-stay accommodation is exacerbating the housing crisis. That's a fact based on evidence, not on fee opinions. We're just asking for a report in this motion, and the Council, in its strategic plan, promises that we will be an inclusive community that has a strong sense of pride and local identity. We will have best practice land use planning systems in place to manage the current and future impacts of development. That's what this report is seeking to unpack. We know that there are significant consequences to the economy and society from not dealing with the housing crisis, and this includes Bruni as well. If you look at Byron Bay, they have restaurants that are fancy restaurants where they're serving the food on paper plates because they can't get the staff to wash the dishes. They have places, businesses in Byron Bay that are shutting after 3 and 4 days in the week because they can't find the staff to afford the rents in Byron Bay, where now 1 in 2 houses that used to be on the rental market are now in short-stay visitor accommodation. Tell me that Bruni Island's different. We need to be smart about our urban planning. We need to look at a report to ultimately get the new councillors up to speed with the information that they need to take meaningful action on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. I'm going to put the motion. It's moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against?
Aye.
Show of hands is required. All those in favour is Councillors Cordova, Midgley, Gladewright and Fox. Those against? Councillors Wass, Street, Bastone, Westwood and Reet. The motion is lost. We come now to a motion that I have submitted, so I'll hand the chair over to the Deputy Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. We have before us a notice of motion by Councillor Reet, moved by Councillor Reet. Do I have a seconder for this motion? Councillor Midgley, over to you, Councillor Reet.
Thank you. Look, I've put forward this motion tonight, and it does relate to matters we've already talked about. During the meetings month before last at the Greater Hobart Mayor's Forum, we had a presentation from the Hobart Women's Shelter, and the statistics on that were very alarming about the number of women and children who were in vulnerable circumstances, were trying to escape domestic violence and couldn't be accommodated in emergency housing, either sort of at that particular crisis point, but then also in the short term as well. The irony of that is that they actually do have state and federal funding in order to build housing, but what they don't have is land. And despite what everybody thinks as a council, we all know as councillors we don't have a lot of land, and it's got to be land that is suitable. We have identified a parcel of land that we do have that is reasonably central, and we've passed that information on to the women's shelter. They have a number of criteria about location to services like schools and CBD and public transport and so on, and we have ticked a lot of those boxes. But this points to a wider problem, and the wider problem is that we have a state government affordable housing strategy that is due to expire next year. There are some words in there. It's a 5-year strategy, and it's got under one year left to run. There's some weasel words in there about looking at different mechanisms and things to try and address planning controls or developer contributions, but nothing has happened, and nobody seems to be pushing it. And I know that the state government is making an effort to put more funding into affordable housing and to build homes, but I do believe that when we have big subdivisions that there is a role for developers to play in contributing some land that then can be used for social and affordable housing. So this was a suggestion that was put forward by the Hobart Women's Shelter that they believed would greatly benefit the sort of medium-term supply issues. I think they had a preference that they came up with a figure, they said 10% or something like that. But we need to be realistic that we can't make policy on the run here, and we need experts in the planning field to have a look at what is the appropriate mechanism and consider things like the size of the subdivision and so on, because you obviously if you're dividing up one large block into two, you wouldn't expect that one of those units becomes affordable and social housing, so you need to come up with a scale. We don't have the expertise to do that. I think it's best done by the state government through the planning laws. The most effective way to do that is to get a motion at a LGAT general meeting that can then go to be considered by all councils to take a united approach and then ask LGAT to lobby the state government, and hopefully that will be more effective because on their own they're not moving it along. So I'll be interested to hear others' views and hope that you can support this. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Reid. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Acting Mayor or Deputy Mayor. I'll support this motion because I support the intention of the motion, and even though I don't much like the wording, I wouldn't let clumsy wording get in the way of supporting a good idea. So this motion asks for Kingborough Council to politely ask the local government of Association of Tasmania to politely ask the state government to please promote more development of affordable housing. Okay, good luck with that. I'll support it, but I don't think it is the timely action that we actually need. I think it's a step in the right direction, but it's a pretty vague step, if I'm perfectly honest. I say ban whole house Airbnb in residential areas, and others say let's please write a nice letter to LGAT asking them to write a nice letter to the state government. Okay, I'll support it, but I won't be holding my breath for any actual action based on this motion. It could be years before we get any action based on this strategy. I think we need to be firm in our resolve to actually contribute to solving this housing crisis. As I mentioned in the last debate, a crisis is something you need to urgently
just
act on.
Just remind you, Councillor Cordova, to address the notice of motion before you.
Thank you. And so to urgently act on the housing crisis, I think we can do a little bit better than asking LGAT to please ask the state government to ultimately take some action. I think we can do that through curbing short-stay accommodation in whole dwellings in residential areas. I think that is something that would actually fix it, but I think this is a nice gesture, and I support it because we need to take every possible step to solve the housing crisis for Kingborough. We need to act urgently, and so I support this, and I think this should just be one of many things that we do. More needs to be done, and faster. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Deputy Mayor. I'm concerned about the definitions which are to relate to affordable housing and social housing. I mean, what is affordable? The thing is that there are a lot of developers out there who are trying to create affordable housing, but the cost of building housing is going up so fast. The materials are going up so fast. The labour force is just not available. And we can have ideals like this, but there are market forces out there that are working out against us. And I do think it's such a complex problem. I mean, we know that this is only part of the solution, but once you build an affordable house, who's going to stop that person using it as a short-term accommodation, the whole house? There is no regulation to stop that happening. We're in a very dangerous, difficult position, and I think it's not just Tasmania, I think it's Australia-wide. And I think when Airbnb first came on the scene, I recall Mayor Dean Winter asking us, do we want a policy on this? And we all thought, well, let's see what happens. It sounds like a good idea. I think that's when we should have set a policy on it. That's when we should have started working on it. Because I think the horse has bolted. I think with housing also the horse has bolted. We have become so popular in Kingborough. Everybody wants to live here. People from the mainland are buying not just one house but five or six houses and then renting them out, or just using them as speculative houses and leaving them empty. They're all escaping from global warming, climate change, from COVID, they're COVID refugees from big cities. But Kingborough is so attractive, and we've made it that way, and that's why people want to come and live here. It's what we've wanted. But
but maybe we have to be more careful about what we wish for. So LGAT is probably the best person to deal with this, but I still feel that I don't think it's going to make a difference. I don't think there's enough being done here on all these fronts. We're just picking off one front at a time. We're not looking at it holistically. And I'm hoping that LGAT can. And I don't know if this motion is going to achieve that. I'd be guided by a wiser person around the table if they think this is going to make a difference.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Councillor Westwood, Acting Chair. Wow, this is a great discussion. I kind of feel guilty sitting here as a councillor and thinking I've been on here for 4 years. And we've come to this last bit of some of our terms before we can actually make any strong policy and strategic kind of decisions, and we're having this discussion. That's just where I personally sit on this. I've worked in the community sector for 25 years, from King's Cross to youth shelters all over Hobart, and we've had a housing crisis for all of that time, and it's in a situation now that we... I wouldn't hope that I would have ever seen when I was in my 20s working with women escaping domestic violence in Sydney. Everyone has a point on this. I think it's really important that we do support what we can. It isn't urgent. It is not going to change for tomorrow. There's many, many conversations we've seen from the City of Hobart about what local government can do in regards to tackling the housing crisis, for a definition of affordable housing from the affordable housing plan. It says refers to rental homes or home purchases that are affordable to low-income households, meaning that the housing costs are low enough that the household is not in housing stress or crisis. During my time on council, I have pointed out that in Spring Farm, and correct me if I'm wrong, General Manager, that there was some findings that there was a covenant on Spring Farm in regards to social or affordable housing not to be built there. Please correct me if I'm wrong in making that statement. I did ask around our own Kingston Park there in regards to Traders in Purple if there could be any social or affordable housing there, and what came back was in regards to, well, if the government gave us some money, then perhaps, you know, we could have looked at affordable housing options. Should we have been stronger in regards to actually making that happen at council? Yeah, we probably should have. But it's come to this point now, and I really hope that people can support this. There is so much research out there in regards to what local governments can do in regards to housing strategies, and I hope that the next council really does consider an affordable housing or a housing strategy for Kingborough to really nail these conversations and to put something on the table so we can have actually a strategic approach and direction and actually what we can do. In this, you know, everyone can just, you know, Google local government, what they can do in regards to affordable and social housing. I found one done by Melbourne School of Design, recommendations for local government housing strategies. And in that, it does adhere to some of the points that the Mayor has put forward in regards to, like, a mandatory inclusionary zoning. So it's stating that, you know, advocate for statewide mandatory inclusionary zoning. That's something that local government can do. That's something that the state government can do. And that's something that, I guess, over our term, this last 4 years on council, we could have seen a number of developments if this was in place, that then they would have had social, could have had affordable housing. So I do thank the Mayor for putting this forward now, getting it in before the time we can't make decisions such as this, and I hope that with the new council going forward that we can have a really more serious discussion around actually what we can do. And I thank the Mayor as well for attending these important meetings, looking at potential blocks of lands for such shelter accommodations and things like that. So yes, it is a bit of a weak sort of thing going through LGAT. Can LGAT even meet during this period? Or that's, I guess... And they can, like, make decisions and actually... So that's really great. And let's hope again that, you know, all councils re-elected moving forward can really strengthen this area, and perhaps when LGAT then comes forward with the whole new elected people, that this can be actually a top priority for local government to deal with.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Deputy Mayor. Deputy Mayor, I'm broadly very supportive of the motion that the Mayor has put forward. I don't think there's any doubt that we need a collective approach as the local government sector and the state government to measures that promote efficient supply of well-located diverse housing and promoting the development of affordable housing with incentives for affordable housing enabled through planning schemes and policies. Absolutely no doubt about that whatsoever. I will be supporting the motion subject to some misgivings around C, which I just want to flag, noting that we are not making a policy decision of council tonight. We are only putting a position to the Legat meeting for further discussion. And so I just make these points in relation to C for noting. And that is that I do have some misgivings around it for one of the reasons that I've already stated tonight in relation to another affordable housing motion, which is unintended consequences. I think we need to be very careful about mandatory provisions, simply because the last thing that I would want to do is create a regime that has the effect of disincentivising development rather than incentivising development. I do have some concerns around that. I think it's an area that we need to tread very, very carefully. But on the basis that, like I say, we're not making a policy decision of council tonight. We are putting a motion forward to Legat for consideration. I think it's important on the basis that I agree with 90% of the motion that I support the motion going, but note those misgivings and say that if I am to be at the Legat meeting where it's considered, that would certainly be a position that I would be putting forward quite strongly, that we need to tread very carefully in relation to C.
Thank you, Councillor Street. If there are no more contributions, Councillor Reid, would you like to sum up?
Yep. Just briefly, I thank councillors for their comments. I appreciate, Councillor Street, what you're saying about C, and, you know, I don't think that we have the expertise around this table to decide what the final model would look like, because it has to be something that's implemented across Tasmania, and so that's why I do think it's an appropriate mechanism for the state government to be doing this, but I think they need a bit of a push to do it. I don't know whether going through Legat I'd call politely or not. I guess I do hope that there's a general meeting coming up on, I think it's the 16th of September, which this motion would go to. So I do hope that it receives the support from other councils around the state so we can get this moving. So thank you very much. And, look forward to seeing this progressing.
Thank you. We have before us a notice of motion submitted by Councillor Reid, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motion is carried unanimously. I will hand the chair back over to the Mayor.
Mayor and the Chair. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we're now on to page 195, only another 55 pages to go. Confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session, confirmation of minutes, applications for leave of absence. That's all. Wow. Looking for a mover and a seconder. Moved Councillor Fox, seconded Councillor Westwood. Thank you. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried. The open session of Council adjourned at 8:50pm. In accordance with Kingborough Council Meetings Audio Recording Guidelines Policy, recording of the open session of the meeting will now cease.